This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
To Be Nation pop listeners, I'm Greg Phillips. With me is most of the time is Nick Duke, and we are
most
the hard
of the time. I'm here every time you are. You're sorry,
yes,
some
but
bitch.
only occasionally do people actually notice that you're here.
Listen to you.
That's a good one, Greg. Thanks, Greg. Hey, we're the hard traveling fanboys. We are welcome to the latest and greatest edition of Countdown. This is the show where we count down, if you will, or even if you won't, our top five favorite things or least favorite things in a given topic. In this case, it's favorite things. And we've got just a magnificent episode lined up for the people. Isn't that right, Nick?
Yes, a fantastic episode of Countdown, which was, of course, the plan all along to have this episode be an episode of Countdown.
Yes, it sure has been. And we have been waiting to give you people this episode for nigh on several weeks now. We've been sitting on gold, we have, because you see, we are joined on this episode in the second half for the countdown portion by none other than Marvel honcho himself, Ben Morse, friend of the Place to Be Nation family.
Get your leprechaun cadence going today. You know, everything is, all we've been doing this, we have. And we're going to do this, we are. Come on now.
To talk like a leprechaun for the rest of the segment?
That's not a leprechaun, that's Chief O'Hara. Big difference.
I'm going to talk like this the rest of the segment, I am. We've got a loaded show for you. Loaded like me baked potatoes. You haven't had one till you've had one from Greg O'Shaughnessy's. And that's why you're listening to the show, aren't you? To hear me funny voices. And to hear Nick's no-selling of them. Ha-ha! In any event, folks, to be serious for a moment, we are very happy that Ben joined us for this show and is going to help us count down all these tremendous, tremendous Marvel video games, the greatest in the history of Marvel Comics attempts at video games. We got them all here. Did your favorite make the show? If it didn't, then it probably wasn't very good. Or we just missed the boat on it, either one. Pick and choose whichever one you want to go with there. We're excited about this episode. We think it's one of our strongest to date, at least the countdown portion. We don't know how good this one's going to go. Judging by how it's gone so far, not very well. But Nick, how are you, sir? I haven't even asked that.
I'm fine. Apparently, you know, I'm not, you know, on a sugar high the way that you are tonight, but I'm doing okay.
Sugar, crack cocaine, who's to tell what the difference is, right? That's right. Now,
I gotta say, in your line of work, they don't usually give you bubble gum. They give you penis.
That's true. But thus far, my head hasn't been separated from my body. So that's a good thing. I guess you could argue if it's a good thing or not. Some days, I kind of wish it would be. But, you know, we've all had a good run to this point, I suppose. So if someone bashes me over the head and knocks my head off and causes me to carry my own head as I run away into the forest, then, you know, it's been a good run, right?
Well, I mean, you'll still be alive if you have the magical crack powers of Tyrone Biggums.
Oh, that's a good point. Good point there, sir. But now, in all seriousness, let's move on with the show, because this is a very serious show. Anyone that listens to us knows how seriously we take comic books, because comic books are serious business. And what better time to start. I just got a bizarre message on Skype from Tim Capel that does not appear to be relevant right now. we're going to take a bit of a break. Nick, tell the folks what they can be expecting on the show today, and tell the folks a little bit about the rundown for this week.
What in the world is going on? Okay, so as Greg mentioned, we're going to have the top five Marvel video games on the back half of the show. But right now, I guess we're going to get the show kicked off with our usual segments. And Greg, you want to start with the rundown this week?
I think we should start with the rundown. We got a pretty loaded rundown segment. There's a lot going on over the past week in the world of comic books and comic book related media. Wouldn't you agree?
A fairly busy week. Nothing. No Comic-Con or anything like that, but, you know, a fairly busy week nonetheless.
Actually, this was busier than New York Comic-Con was, to be honest with you.
Well, I'm, you know, when I say Comic-Con, I
you mean San Diego
I mean
Comic-Con.
The one true
SDCC,
Comic-Con.
As the cool kids call it.
Indeed. So, where do you want to start with the rundown, Greg?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it really doesn't matter. There's so many things to talk about. Let's start off with the X-Men Cinematic Universe from Fox. There was a report that came out this past week, obviously, that says that the studio is planning to, quote, reconfigure, end quote, the X-Men film universe. Apparently, Apocalypse did not perform to what the studio was hoping. And in addition to that, they don't have their actors locked into contracts anymore. They're the Jennifer Lawrence, James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, no longer under contract. So they're looking to almost do a reboot or a reconfiguring, as they're calling it, of the X-Men universe, which is sort of unusual since they kind of just rebooted it with First Class not that long ago. But anyway, this looks to be another reboot potentially with Simon Kinberg attached, who has written several of the films. He is working on a follow-up to X-Men Apocalypse, apparently with Jennifer Lawrence, James McAvoy, and Michael Fassbender's characters included, or at least the idea of them being included. Bryan Singer will not be back to direct, and, you know, it looks like they're going to kind of reshape everything and build around Deadpool to an extent. They're already planning on Deadpool 3, and 2 hasn't even come out. So there's just a lot going on right now in the X-Men film universe. What do you make of all this movement here, Nick?
Well, one of the things I had read, which actually makes some sense, and this makes sense even before this report, is that the idea would be for these next couple of main X-Men movies to not be so heavily focused on Xavier, Magneto, and Mystique, and rather be focused around Cyclops, Jean Grey, and the rest of the younger characters introduced in Apocalypse. So, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense from a narrative standpoint anyway. It also makes sense from, a financial standpoint. You're not going to be able to afford Jennifer Lawrence, especially, you know, for the next 10 to 15 years. You know, you gotta have a succession plan at some point, and having these younger actors step in and take over as the face of the franchise makes a lot of sense, in my opinion. As far as Deadpool 3 goes, they should probably get Deadpool 2 sorted away with a director and everything before they put the cart ahead of the horse, so to speak.
Right, yeah. My big thing is they don't need to reboot the franchise. I think that would be a huge mistake. There's no need for it. Build around the characters you introduced in Apocalypse. Go from there. Whatever. That'll be great. That'll be fine. That'll be perfect even. So, good. I view it as logical. And frankly, as great as he's been in these movies, and Fassbender has arguably been the best part of these movies since First Class, you know, time to move on from Magneto. Every movie doesn't need to have Magneto as the or a villain in it. So let's move on from that, okay? The X-Men has one of the best rogues galleries in all of comics. Time to start digging deep into that rogues gallery and using some of the other characters. So, looking forward to that. Nick, what's next on the plate?
Let's see. What else do we have this week? One thing that I know probably caught your eye that was interesting to me was the announcement of a television series featuring your favorite characters in all the Marvel Universe.
Oh, yeah.
Those, of course, being the Inhumans. They have been announced, officially confirmed, to be getting a 2017 fall ABC television series, which is, you know, somewhat interesting. But the very interesting part of this to me, Greg, is that it was announced that the first two episodes of this series will be debuting exclusively in IMAX theaters. And not only that, but IMAX is going to help co-finance part of this, and the first two episodes will be shot exclusively using IMAX digital cameras. So this is kind of an interesting cooperation between ABC, Marvel, and IMAX, of all people, who are getting into the television business, it sounds like. So very, very interesting partnership here, even if the creative content may not be the most interesting.
Well, quite frankly, they're getting into the television business, and that's fine. Marvel's in the entertainment business. Two different businesses.
That's true. That's true. Various reports have said that this apparently, quote, will have an impact on the MCU, but I would argue we've heard that claimed before when it comes to Marvel television. And I've also read another report, I believe, on comicbook.com, if I'm not mistaken, that said that it will not necessarily even have to be tied to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Now, I don't know how that will work, having not seen a lot of the Inhumans-related Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff, but apparently this could be a fairly standalone and clean break project from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That will certainly be unique after last season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., in which they pretty much turned it into an Inhuman show anyway. Or, more accurately, their version of the Inhumans, which are essentially the X-Men. Just a boring, uninteresting version of the X-Men. They should have never happened or been allowed to be greenlit.
Right. You know,
in other words, I can't wait for this show. I'm super excited.
Yeah, I can't speak from an overwhelming position of authority, having not seen season 3 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but I would imagine that, you know, with the Inhumans film being tabled and backburnered and probably not ever happening now, I would think that a lot of the material that was going to be covered in that movie would probably be covered in this now, because from what we're reading, this will be focused largely on the classic cast of Inhumans characters, those being, you know, Black Bolt and Medusa and Karnak and, you know, Crystal and the characters of you know, in that category, rather than some of the Inhumans that I've heard were used on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 3.
Oh, you mean it's not going to be based around terrible CGI blue creature that grows spikes out of him that was married to May? Oh, that's amazing. I can't wait.
You know, I don't know anything about
all that. It's not going to be based around Coulson and his fake hand? Oh, man, I'm stoked.
I also don't know anything about that.
Those things. That's awesome. I cannot wait. I can't wait to see another ABC Marvel show. But that being said, in all seriousness, all the snark removed, all my distaste for the Inhumans removed, the IMAX association is interesting. Visually, it should be interesting. Hopefully, it will focus on interesting characters doing interesting things. That would be nice. I will give it a shot, as I've given every Marvel TV show a shot. Except Luke Cage, which I haven't had time to watch yet. And we'll see. We will see how it turns out, Nick. I am just super, super excited for it.
Well, Greg, much like the internet, don't let your true feelings get in the way of any snark.
That's true. Speaking of true feelings, actually, there's really no transition here. One of the characters that has gone through a lot of feelings over the years is Daredevil, and Daredevil has three spinoff books happening, announced by Marvel recently. We're getting
folks. Greg Phillips has just thrown the format sheet out the window here.
That's right. That's right. We're getting Kingpin, written by Matthew Rosenberg, with art by Ben Torres. We're getting Bullseye, written by Ed Brisson, with art by Guillermo Sana. And we're getting Elektra, written by Matt Owens, with art by Alec Morgan. I literally know none of these creators. Nor do I know much about these characters in the comics, except for Kingpin and Daredevil. But these books are coming out. It looks like Elektra's look is going to be heavily inspired by her look on the Daredevil TV show. Presumably, these books are coming out to capitalize on the success and popularity of the TV show. I do not know what Daredevil's current status quo is, as I haven't read his book in quite a while. But it should be interesting to see how this plays out. What do you make of Daredevil getting his own, I guess, line of titles?
It's interesting for sure. I've only read the first couple of issues of the Charles Soule Daredevil, but I really enjoyed what I saw. But you know, as we've discussed before, Daredevil's one of those characters. I don't know that I've ever actually read a bad Daredevil comic. Now, that's not to say I've read a ton of Daredevil, but just seems to be a character that has a ridiculously long track record of high quality books that just continue to be rolled out year after year. So, not saying that necessarily will apply to the spinoff titles, but if they can bring a little of that magic over, then you know, good for Marvel.
I think the key has been that Daredevil has had the best run of creators of any character at Marvel, probably. I mean, you've gone since the 80s, you've gone from Frank Miller to Ann Nesenti, who was really good in her day, to there was somebody in the 90s. I can't remember who did it in the 90s. And then it moved. Eventually, you got that run of Kevin Smith, Brian Michael Bendis, Ed Brubaker, Mark Waid, and now Charles Soule. So I think it's more to do with the creators necessarily than the character, but the character does seem to lend. I mean, he's basically Marvel's Batman in terms of storytelling premise, the dark, gritty, emotionally tortured type character, and there seems to be a lot of story to mine out of that. The question I have is, to me, it's very difficult to get an ongoing series or even a limited series out of a villain character. I think it can be done. It has been done, certainly to good effect. Characters like Sinestro, Magneto, in recent years have gotten good titles. There have been countless good miniseries in the past. But someone like the Kingpin, for instance, who is just an irredeemably scummy human being, it's awfully hard to make a compelling series about that person, in my opinion. So it's going to be interesting to watch. Elektra should be a slam dunk. Bullseye and the Kingpin, maybe even Bullseye more so than Kingpin, I don't know. But both of those should be very interesting to read because I'm not sure what the hook is going to be there.
Yeah, I don't know either. But like you said, the villain-focused series has kind of seen a renaissance in recent years with Sinestro and Magneto, and Marvel is also launching a Thanos title here in the next very soon, maybe even next week or so. So, you know, Marvel's certainly trying new things, and you can't knock that, so we'll see how it turns out.
You can't teach that either.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's a Thanatos ongoing starting soon, apparently.
Now that's a completely different story. I mean, and what's awesome is each, you know, in the gimmick cover, each number one will come with a real tuft of beautiful, manageable hair attached to the front.
And just when you thought that the hard-traveling fanboys could not dig down any further into their list of obscure pop culture references, we just referenced Mr. Nanny, folks.
Let us not forget the underlying truth that truly defines our entire worldview. That, of course, being
Thanatos is
Poindexter.
And Poindexter is Thanatos. Yep. In any event, let's go back to the big screen for one of the more bizarre stories of the week, the revelation that, according to Deadpool screenwriter Paul Wernick, in order to use Negasonic Teenage Warhead in the Deadpool movie, Fox had to trade, essentially, the rights to Ego the Living Planet to Marvel Studios in order to obtain the right to alter the on-screen powers of Negasonic Teenage Warhead. Now, as created by Grant Morrison in the comics, Negasonic Teenage Warhead has psychic abilities of some kind. Now, in the movie, of course, they changed that to where she can kind of create almost a blast radius around herself, like an energy blast type deal. Really cool change, worked awesome for the movie, turned out great. Now, Marvel obtained the rights to use Ego the Living Planet, which is going to appear in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and be played apparently by Kurt Russell and Kurt Russell's mustache. So, certainly an interesting trade. You have to wonder, are there any players to be named later involved in the trade?
I have no idea about that, but I don't understand how any of this works at this point, because I would think Ego, the Living Planet, would be a Thor villain more than anything else that Marvel will retain the rights to.
I think he's more associated with Fantastic Four.
He made his debut in Thor, and a lot of his appearances have been made in Thor.
Right, but a lot of his appearances have been made in Fantastic Four. When I was a kid, I knew him from Fantastic Four.
That's a good point, but I'm saying that he first appeared in the pages of Thor, and based on how they've defined a lot of these other characters' ownership, that I thought would define, you know, the same thing for Ego, that because he debuted in Thor, he would be, you know, considered a Marvel property. But I don't know how any of this works, but at this point, just good that Fox and Marvel are still willing to...
By that logic, Wolverine appeared for the first time in the pages of The Incredible Hulk.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good example, although an extreme one, I would argue. But in any event, it just shows it's a good thing that these two studios are at least willing to work together now, where in years past, you know, the relationship was very, very contentious. So maybe, perhaps, this is laying the groundwork for a greater partnership to come, one would hope.
Yes, or at the very least, more exciting trades in the future. So keep an eye out for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Hopefully the trade will work out as well for them as it worked out for Fox with Deadpool. And we'll have to see how that goes. Now, keeping things on the moving down to the small screen, television that is, one of the projects that has been floating around in developmental hell for the longest amount of time in comics is Why the Last Man. If you haven't read this or don't know what Why the Last Man is, it was a creator-owned – or not creator-owned. It was a Vertigo title created by Brian K. Vaughan and Pia Guerra back in the early 2000s. And both Nick and I have read the entire thing. Great series. In fact, probably one of the best complete series that you'll find, honestly. Certainly one of the best of the decade and one of my favorites of all time. Well, it's been kind of in developmental hell when it comes to a TV and movie property for years. There was talk of doing a movie about it. There was talk at one time of doing an HBO series about it, and Brian K. Vaughan was attached to produce. That kind of fell by the wayside. Now, apparently, finally, FX, a popular television network, has hired Michael Green to be the showrunner for the anticipated Why the Last Man live-action series. This is according to The Hollywood Reporter. Green currently is the showrunner for Starz American Gods, and he will write the pilot script with Brian K. Vaughan, which is good, and apparently it's set to go. It looks like we're finally getting movement on this project that has gone through quite a few ups and downs over the years. At one point, New Line was going to create a movie with director DJ Caruso and screenwriters David Goyer and Carl Ellsworth.
And actor Shia LaBeouf.
Yes, Shia LaBeouf was indeed attached to the project at one time. So thank the Lord for small favors, I suppose. Green also does have comic book experience. He co-wrote Green Lantern. Co-wrote Logan, which is an upcoming film, wrote Superman Batman, relaunched Supergirl in the New 52. So he has some comic book experience. BKV is one of, if not the best writers in comics. So it should be a theoretically a match made in heaven. Now, here's the two questions that I'm going to pose to my cohort here. And think I know that we're going to be on the same page on this. First of all, Why the Last Man, better as a movie or a TV series, in your opinion?
Absolutely a TV series.
Yes, 100% agreed. Now, here's one that I'm not 100% sure of on myself. Do you think FX is a good fit for it, or is it a concept and a book that needs to be on a premium station with no limits?
You know, obviously, if you're looking for a direct adaptation, it would probably fit better on a premium network. However, I will say that FX, I don't know if you've seen any of their adaptation of The Strain, which I've only caught a little bit of. Mm-hmm. FX has kind of been pushing the limits in terms of content over the last few years, and I think Why the Last Man is one of those where the more graphic and adult aspects of it aren't necessarily as intrinsic to the story as something like Preacher. So I think
I would agree.
Work actually.
I would agree with that. Why The Last Man? It's more so language and sexuality content as opposed to extreme amounts of violence and really even extreme amounts of language. The language is there, but it's not like Preacher. You know, it's toned down from that. It's not like 100 Bullets even. So, you know, I'm excited about this. I think FX could be a good fit for it, and certainly an exciting project to finally see to fruition. Well, let's wrap up the rundown finally by getting to the comic books, actual comic books, people. We are going to talk about actual comic books because after months of DC being on top, Marvel is back on top again of the comic book sales charts. Not Chael's Sarts or Chael Sharts, for that matter. But
I don't want to
charts.
Know anything about Chael Sonnen Sharts. Thank you very much.
Hey, I'll have you know, as a longtime MMA fan, Chael Sonnen Sharts are the stuff of legends, let me tell you. In any event, Marvel is back on top largely on the strength of the the new Marvel Now initiative that started in October 2016. They got a new boost, I guess, to their line of titles, books particularly like Champions number 1, which was the number 2 selling book, but really the number 1 selling book. We'll get to that in a second. Doctor Strange and the Sorcerer's Supreme number 1 on the strength of the movie coming out, sitting there at number 3, and the Civil War number 2 number Civil War 2 number 6, mm-hmm. for God's sake. Snuck into the top 10 at number 7. Darth Vader is in there. So Marvel's got some good titles in there. DC, looks like DC has got Dark Knight 3. It's got a bunch of Batman books, essentially. Dark Knight 3, Batman 8, Batman 9, and All-Star Batman number 3, all in the top 10. And, of course, The Walking Dead number 159 makes its entry on at number 10. So Marvel is – albeit narrowly, back on top of the sales charts on unit market share. They're at 36.5%. DC's at 34.7%. And then on retail market share, Marvel's at 35.8%. DC is at 30.7%. So pretty narrow margin between the two companies right now. Overall, sales are up in 2016 over 2015. So that's good news. The initiative worked. And then the weird aspect of all this is that the actual number one selling comic of the month was the Boom crossover between Kurt Russell properties, Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York number 1, although it is on top due to its inclusion in Loot Crate's November offering. So
Technically counts towards its sales.
So that's that's sitting at number 1 right now, which, hey, good for them, man. Nothing against that. So it looks like things are perhaps getting back to normal. Or is this just a blip on the radar, and are we going to see more months of jockeying back and forth?
You got to remember, this was Marvel's relaunch. A lot of number 1s coming out, which is what I had said all along, that I kept pointing to October when we were touting the Rebirth sales numbers. I wanted to see what happened in October. And even though Marvel's on top, I would say this is still mostly good news for DC because with all these number ones launched, DC isn't that far behind. I wouldn't be surprised at all if November and December saw DC retake the top spot, especially once Justice League versus Suicide Squad starts, which has gotten a lot of publicity and a lot of hype to this point. So, you know, the story is as yet unfinished, I think, as to who kind of really controls the comic book landscape right now.
I actually agree with that. I thought the same thing when I saw these numbers, because while they're very good for Marvel to be back in a good position, and it feels like the general goodwill is starting to go back their way a little bit, it still feels like DC is strong. DC's holding the line, not at $2.99, but holding the line.
Well, they are mostly holding the line at $2.99.
Well, right?
Except for All-Star Batman.
Batman, for God's sake. But they're holding the line right now. They're putting out strong quality content. Their sales haven't suffered, and they have made the marketplace more competitive, which is all you can ask for, because you know, if you look at the different, I mean, Marvel was just crushing them the last 2 years in sales, and it really has evened out, which is good for the industry, good for the fans. Controversy and competition create cash. So some lessons that you people can learn if you will start watching professional wrestling, the greatest sport of them all, right, Nick?
Indeed.
Now, let's move on to everybody's favorite segment.
Read on and watch out. What you be reading and watch out.
What you been reading and watching?
Ah, yes. The dulcet tones of David. I'm not gonna give away his whole name. You'll have to seek it out. We don't wanna get too many people on his trail and get him signed away by some big record company. In any event, if you want to hear more jingles like that, just hit me up and I'll see if I can negotiate something. In any event, this is our favorite segment of the show. Actually, it's not, but it's one of our favorite segments of the show, and we only have a few, so certainly it's on the list somewhere, where we're going to tell you our favorite comics of the week and our least favorite comic of the week. Where should we begin, Nicholas?
Well, I suppose we'll start. You know, we've kind of been leaning on the watching stuff lately, so let's shake things up a bit and go back to the reading.
Fascinating. Well, let's start out with our number three book of the week. Nick?
Sure. All right, my number three book of the week is, you know, somewhat predictable, seeing as how I'd been hyping this one up in my own head for a little while, but I'm going to go with The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows number one from Jerry Conway and Ryan Stegman. Not crazy about Stegman's art, and I had forgotten that before I read this book, but I very much enjoyed the dynamic between Peter, MJ, and Annie in this. It's, you know, clearly trying to capitalize on a little bit of the success that DC has enjoyed with the reintroduction of the pre-New 52 Superman into its universe. But all that being said, that doesn't stop me from enjoying it. I'm one of those pro-marriage guys. That's what I've always enjoyed. That's the dynamic that I grew up with, was Peter and MJ, and I'm glad to see it back here. And even more so, glad to see them, you know, raising their daughter, which is something that they've, you know, Marvel has kind of ducked and dodged for the better part of two decades now, the issue of them having children. So really enjoyed this one and very anxious to see where the series goes from here.
And I'm a pro-polygamy guy, so, you know, I think that's what makes us who we are.
You are, of course, a Utah Jazz fan, so it makes sense that you're
right.
A pro-polygamy.
I am a Utah Jazz fan. I believe every person should have six – every man should have six wives, and every wife should have seven husbands if they so choose.
How would the math of that even work out?
You know, I didn't really think that joke through before I made it. But sometimes you just got to go with your gut, Nick, even if your gut is illegal. Mm-hmm. So I'll go on to my number three comic book of the week, which is – again, I'm catching up, folks. So this is an old comic. I'm catching up, and not doing it very quickly. But I've got Action Comics number 963, the – first issue of Meet Clark Kent, I think is the name of the story. Yep, Meet Clark Kent, part one. Not great, but not bad either. Pretty good. I enjoyed it. The mystery has got me hooked. I'm not really sure what this Clark Kent's angle is yet. I haven't finished the story, so don't spoil it if you have. I don't buy that he's actually Clark Kent. He could be an alternate dimension Clark Kent. That seems to be the way they're wanting me to think. I think differently. I think he's a clone. I think he's an imperfect clone of Clark Kent that was produced by this mysterious group and truly thinks that he is Clark Kent. So we'll see how it all turns out down the line. But this is by Dan Jurgens and Patrick Zercher, by the way. Again, continues to be an entertaining series.
Awesome. My number two book of the week, I'm going with Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 8. You know, this is the first part of the Bottled Light storyline. And one of the things about the previous storyline, you know, that we talked about is how refreshing it was to see Robert Venditti really, you know, show a grasp of who Hal Jordan is and who Sinestro was. And he wrote both of those guys, you know, to perfection in that first story arc. I would also throw Guy Gardner in there as a character that just continued to have standout moment after standout moment. Well, here in this first issue, I thought he really got to the core of who John Stewart and Kilowog are. I thought he wrote those two characters as well as he's ever written them, and also finally had Soren Ignatiu seeming like the Soren Ignatiu that we all knew and loved from Geoff Johns' run. So, you know, this book continues to impress. It continues to be a massive reclamation project for Venditti's entire Green Lantern tenure, and I continue to be a big, big fan of it. So, Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 8. That's my number 2 book of the week.
Outstanding. Really looking forward to catching up on that. And if anyone can get me a copy of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 3 so that I can actually read all the rest of them that I've collected since then, it would really be great. You can find me on Twitter at gphillips8652, or you can comment in the Place to Be Nation Facebook page if you have a copy of that book, a digital copy, whatever, that you can get me. That I can take a look at and actually read, because I've had no luck finding it locally. So anyway,
and if you want to buy some early '90s Image comics, you know, of course you can hit me up as well.
Indeed, including the Max with like 9 X's.
Yes.
On to my number 2, Green Arrow number 8, which is Island of Scars, Part 1. This is essentially a romance comic between Oliver Queen and Dinah Lance. They're stranded on an island together. They make whoopee. They have a bonding adventure of sorts on the island. Very cool comic. Very different from what you would expect from a superhero comic. Also a comic that I would love, absolutely love to show to all the comic book fans, so quote unquote comic book fans, who bitch and moan about the CW shows being too soap opera heavy. They would absolutely rip this comic in half if they started reading it, because it's almost all romance. And I loved it. Thought it was great. Reminded me of why this relationship in the comics is so wonderful. And again, a great reminder that romance is a big part of superhero comics and always has been. So, great job by Ben Percy and my favorite Green Arrow artist on this current series, Otto Schmidt. I am so glad to see Otto Schmidt back and in good form.
Indeed, I agree with all of your sentiments about that particular book. I loved it as well. My number 1 book of the week is Batman Detective Comics number 944. This is the second part of the Victim Syndicate storyline. As I discussed last week, Greg, this is an incredibly simple and yet effective new concept for a villain, for a villainous group, I should say. We get to know a little bit more about them, what their power sets are, how they're coming after Batman, and what their intentions are in this issue, and I absolutely loved it. We also get to see the reintroduction of Luke Fox into the Bat family, so to speak, and it seems like he's going to kind of be taking over the role of the technical expert that Tim Drake had filled in the book to this point. So very much enjoyed this one. The Batman line as a whole is possibly, you know, reaching heights right now that we haven't seen in some time. Loved this book. Loving the entire direction of this line. If you're not on this right now, please, please, please go out and pick up Detective Comics. It has been outstanding to this point.
And while we're talking about incredibly strong lines right now, let's move over to the other DC stalwart, Superman, because my number one comic in a landslide, without any competition, one of the best comics I've read all year, Superman number 7 by Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason. Phil Jimenez, I believe, or Jorge Jimenez, I believe, was the artist who drew this. Let me double check that real quick before I commit to saying it. Yes, Jorge Jimenez was the artist. Patrick Gleason and Peter Tomasi wrote it. This is, again, a comic with almost no action. Pretty much no action at all, in fact. But just gets to the heart of its characters in a way that defines Superman to me, defines the Superman line. All heart, all family, all love. And that's what comes off the page in this book. This is just about the Kent family, or the Smith family, if you will. It's their disguise, but it's the Kent family. Going out to the county fair and just having a family day out. What an amazing issue this was. I was gripped with every page. The way that young Jonathan is drawn is just amazing. Perfect. His blossoming romance with the girl Kathy who lives near them. Well, not a romance yet, but they're, you know, they clearly kind of dig each other, so that's cool. It's just a cute, fun book, and the last page is just perfect. The last two pages, I should say, where Clark's trying to convince Lois that he didn't do any superheroics during their day out that he promised to the family, and then she finds out that he basically did, and the look of anger on her face and the look of fear on his face, amazing. Can't say enough about this book in general, this series in general, but this is probably my favorite issue. In fact, I'll say it's definitely my favorite issue that I've read yet of Superman. So, outstanding job by everyone involved.
Yeah, it took you a while to get there, but I knew you would love it once you did, so no surprise there that that wound up finishing at your number one spot for the week.
Yep. On to our worst pick of the week. Yours, sir?
You know, this is once again one of those weeks where there wasn't really a bad book that I read. Granted, not like last week where I had to, you know, list a legitimately great book as my bottom book of the week. But I'm going to go Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 4. I enjoyed this one very much. You know, the story continues to be interesting to me. The Benson sisters continue to write these characters in a believable fashion. And I would even say that the art slightly improved, where the characters don't look quite as weird as they have in recent issues. So I really enjoyed this one all around. It's just, you know, I had some other books that I enjoyed a little bit more, and this one did, you know, kind of a little bit feel like a filler issue of sorts that wasn't really a whole lot going on, but still, like I said, for the most part, enjoyed this one.
Very good. My worst book of the time period is... No, I would stop short of calling it a terrible book, but I didn't think it was very good. I thought it was a low point thus far. Maybe not a low point, but probably the second worst book that I've read in this line since it relaunched, and that's Green Arrow number 9, Island of Scars Part 2. The stuff with Oliver and Dinah is great.
But the villains are awful.
The villains were not interesting at all. Very heavy-handed. The writing was very heavy-handed. The political allegory was, you know, I mean, just beating me over the head with it, like to the point where it wasn't much of an allegory at all.
Beating you about the head and neck area?
Yes, as Mr. Jericho might say. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the inhabitants of this Island of Scars, you know what happens when you're a boring character and you don't interest me in the pages of a comic that I otherwise enjoy? You just made the list! Characters whose names I can't remember.
Well, that's not a very effective list, then, if you don't have the names of the characters on it.
I'm just writing characters I can't remember from Green Arrow number 9. And also, as has been, if there is a kryptonite to Ben Percy's Green Arrow, it's the way that he wraps up some of his arcs. I did not think his first arc was wrapped up in a satisfactory manner. Well, the first arc actually kind of was, but the brief two-parter that took place in Japan,
Sins of the Mother,
yes, was not wrapped up in a satisfactory manner. The second issue was, in fact, really bad. That's my least favorite issue of this book so far. And Island of Scars Part 2 was not a satisfactory conclusion to the story they set up in the first part. I don't know if it's that he's rushing these stories a little bit too much, trying to fit in too much in just two issues. But I think that while I really enjoy his run, I think his story arcs get progressively less interesting as they go, which is somewhat of a concern. We'll see if he can rein that in with this upcoming arc.
I will say that I very much enjoyed the first issue of the latest arc, and I'll be interested to hear your thoughts once you get that, when you get there.
Again, the starts of the arcs are not a problem. They've all been great.
Right. Real quick, I got a few quick hits. Only three this week. Wonder Woman number 10. This continues the year one storyline, and it continues this book on a phenomenal track. It's got a lot of momentum going. Continue to love this book. You should be reading it if you're not. All-Star Batman number 4, not quite as good as numbers 2 or 3, but still quite a good Batman comic, and still one that Greg is not going to read because it costs $4.99.
That's right.
And finally, Action Comics 967. This is Men of Steel Part 1. Still a little too dialogue-heavy for my taste. I'm ready for this one to get back to being an action comic, but overall, enjoyed this one.
Very good, very good. Well, let's move on to watching, which has become one of our, would you say, probably our most packed segment of every week, would you say, Nick?
Yeah, this time of year especially.
Yeah, yeah. So let's quickly get into it. We'll start off with last Monday's Supergirl, which featured James Olsen having something of a crisis of conscience as he decides that he feels the need to become a hero of sorts. You also saw the blossoming romance between Maggie Sawyer and Alex Danvers.
Now we don't know that, you know,
the blossoming seeming romance, the sparks flying between Danvers and Sawyer. The Mon-El attempting to get a job at the Catco company,
and attempting to get something else at Catco.
Yeah, and succeeding apparently.
until Kara messed things up a bit.
Yes. So overall, I mean, another fun episode. All the stuff with Kara and Mon-El was phenomenal. I thought, like, Mon-El has been a great addition to the show, and Kara's, I don't know if you would agree with me on this, Nick, but one of the best parts of Supergirl, in my opinion, just for my enjoyment, is Kara's reactions. Melissa Benoist has some of the best facial reactions to things of any character of any of the shows that I watch. She is so great at just, whether it's being angry about something, whether it's being happy about something, or my favorite, when she's just utterly shocked and or disgusted by something. She's just so great at it. Her disgust at finding Mon-El and Miss Tessmacher in the closet was spot on.
It was Greg Phillips-esque, I'll put it that way.
Yes.
Overreaction on the level of Greg Phillips when he sees something that disgusts him.
Yes, it was wonderful. And I love her as a character. She's awesome. Mon-El has been a great addition. So a lot of good stuff to love in that episode. Very little Henshaw, which I always am a little hesitant when they don't feature Henshaw very much, because he's one of my favorite parts of the show. But all of the stuff involving James Olsen was cringeworthy.
It was awful. I do not know. I genuinely don't know at this point what they are going for with the James Olsen character. I'm not going to buy him as a badass. I'm just not.
No.
Especially when you just casually drop in about, what is it, 25 episodes in at this point that, oh, he just happens to be a black belt, and we forgot to mention it. Sorry.
Yeah.
You don't actually mention what he's
a black belt in what?
Yeah. He's a black belt, Greg.
That's not how martial arts work. You don't just become a black belt in generic martial arts.
But he has a black belt.
You have a black belt too, right?
Yeah, I got a black belt. I wear it, you know, sometimes when I tuck my shirt in. I wear it to work on certain days. So I guess that means I'm qualified to do spin kicks and wear terrible costumes.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The Seinfeld gif moment of the episode for me was when James Olsen just randomly does a spinning wheel kick to one of his assailants as they got out of the van. I'm like, okay, I understand that it's a different version of James Olsen than the comics, but for God's sake, are you just trying to rub it in people's faces that this is not Jimmy Olsen? Like, a spinning round kick? Come on! Okay, ridiculous, stupid, not entertaining, not interesting. Him clenching his fist like the baby in those memes, also a cringeworthy moment. So, I liked the episode as I thought about it. I thought it was good overall because the rest of the cast was so wonderful. But man, and it's not even the actor. It's really not the actor's fault. It's just a boring, uninteresting character.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's just there's nothing here. I mean, there's nothing. Why should we be invested on his path to becoming some sort of vigilante? They've given us no reason to buy into this character at this point, so I don't know.
And then, of course, nothing interesting happened on Tuesday night. Moving along from that, on Wednesday, we had a brand new episode of Arrow, and I would argue another very good episode of Arrow. This was the first real Prometheus episode, I would say.
Yeah.
We really got to dig in on Prometheus as a villain. He's clearly taken over as the new big bad of the show now that Tobias Church has been taken care of. And really started to knock down some dominoes that could have some pretty big effects the rest of the season. I don't think that either of us are buying the red herring that was laid out in this past week's episode, but it's certainly interesting nonetheless. And I don't know about you, Nick, but I really got a season one vibe out of this episode, the way that they're laying out the mystery of who this guy is, and the way that they're kind of putting all the chess pieces in place and starting to really see that this is a villain that's going to give Oliver some problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I also love this one. You know, carrying over from the previous week's episode, you know, I have enjoyed Arrow this entire season. I don't think I was enjoying it quite as much as you were to start with, but now this one is hitting all the notes that I want out of my beloved Arrow. So loving this direction, loving everything about it, loving the way they're handling Prometheus to this point. Not loving... Let's go ahead and talk about it, Greg. What is Felicity's borderline obsession with the new team?
I don't know. The new team sucks. I'm just going to go ahead and say it.
The new team is awful.
They're not good.
New team, you can go to hell.
Dennis Rodman just did an arm drag. Damn it. Sorry, that was an unnecessary wrestling reference.
I think in Arrow season 5, Dennis Rodman just did an arm drag would be on the equivalent of Wild Dog just did something useful. Like that's the level of shock it would be.
Oh man, no, thus far this season we've predominantly focused our hatred on Wild Dog. This episode, Evelyn Sharp got to step up to the plate.
Which is really unfortunate because they haven't given her anything to do all season long. When they finally give her something to do, guess what? Stop me if you've heard this one before. It's bitching about something Oliver has done.
Which Oliver did 4 years ago.
Yes, but that seems to be every character except Diggle's favorite pastime at this point is, let me find something to complain about that Oliver has done.
That's accurate. So,
do any of them actually like Oliver? Why do they work with him? Why don't they just go do their own thing, for God's sake?
She spent the whole episode. I mean, just quit bitching, people. I mean, listen, what's his name? Curtis. Just go back behind the damn computer if all you're going to do is bitch and moan all the time.
I got it. Curtis, go behind the computer. Wild Dog, go somewhere
else.
Step
in front of that subway train.
Evelyn Sharp, just fade quietly into obscurity. Ragman, go be on Legends of Tomorrow. And the rest of you, you know, and then get back to the team we know and love. And Felicity, yeah, Act like you like Oliver. You did it for one episode. You can do it again.
Yeah,
I know you can.
These teammates, you know, I'm just saying, they right now, they're on my bad side. And originally it was just going to be Wild Dog, but if they keep it up, they're going to get it. And by it, I mean put in front of Negan and bash with a barbed wire bat until their brains are goo.
Now, is it going to be Jeffrey Dean Morgan Negan or Dave Chappelle Negan?
Can it be both?
Oh, how awesome would that be?
That would be amazing. That's the crossover the world needs. Now, let me also – we can't skip over Arrow without talking about Dolph freaking London. Lundgren, even. Not even – who the hell is Dolph London? I don't know. Paul London's brother, I guess. Dolph Lundgren making his Arrow debut as Konstantin Kovar. Phenomenal. So good. Big mark out moment for me, Nick.
Yeah, I liked it as well. The flashbacks, I would argue, have been the strongest flashbacks since season 2, probably. So
yeah,
I continue to love those and be kind of blown away by how drastically that aspect of the show has improved from last season to this season.
The scene with Konstantin Kovar giving the seemingly irrelevant story about the turnip on the farm to Oliver was almost Negan-esque to me. Like, it was really well done, very creepy, very if it wasn't a flashback, you would genuinely have fear for Oliver's safety in that scene because it was so expertly crafted, I guess you would say. Just a really good scene, really good introduction to the character.
I agree. Should we talk about the seeming misdirection by the writers?
You know what? It's been – by the time this goes up, it will have been over a week, so let's do it. Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! the implication given by the end of the episode is that Prometheus is none other than Quentin Lance, although seemingly Quentin Lance has no idea that he is Prometheus, if he is a Prometheus, because he was cut on the arm, and Prometheus was cut on the arm by Evelyn Sharp. Now, I don't think either one of us is buying what they're selling on this one, but it's an admirable attempt. Would you agree?
I would agree it's an admirable attempt. I just don't – for several reasons. One, I don't think they have any intention of actually revealing who Prometheus is this early in the season. So it smacks of misdirection and seems to be an obvious red herring. Two, I don't think they can believably make Quentin Lance a physical threat to Oliver at this point. And, three, it just wouldn't make a whole lot of sense given the story they're telling. Now, some would argue that – you know, the losses of Sarah and Laurel could certainly drive Quentin to blame Oliver for things. But, you know, I just see those two characters as having grown too close over the years. And, you know, that's a dynamic I don't think the writers are wanting to throw away for this twist. So I'm not buying it.
What do you make of the concept of Quentin Lance almost becoming a Two-Face-like figure where he has a split personality? One that is still loyal to Oliver and one that is a mortal enemy of Oliver.
I've seen that bandied about as well. My argument to that would be, okay, so his secondary personality just left and in 3 months learned how to become, like, you know, essentially a giant badass.
Well, here's my theory. My theory is that Quentin really was Prometheus on the subway train. But he's not the real Prometheus. He was in the suit, and he's being manipulated by the real Prometheus. Because the reason that makes me think that is Evelyn Sharp was actually holding her own in that fight. Right. And everything that we've been shown about Prometheus to this point is that nobody can really hold their own in a fight with him that we've been introduced to this point. We haven't seen him fight Oliver, but we've seen him fight Tobias Church and just completely demolish him. So I find it hard to believe that Evelyn, although Evelyn's a capable archer and a capable fighter in her own right, I find it hard to believe that she would have been able to land a significant blow on Prometheus. So I think that it probably was Quentin, and he is being manipulated somehow by whoever the real Prometheus is.
That's a possibility. I would also say that perhaps this is just Prometheus' way of – you know, essentially screwing with somebody that Oliver's extremely close to by, you know, cutting him on the arm and making him think that he might have done something that he doesn't realize he's doing. You know, maybe this will be Prometheus might be, you know, seeking to psychologically torture each of Oliver's closest allies as the season goes on.
Right. And also, Thea had a great moment where she shut down Wild Dog's advances on her, which was nice to see. So
absolutely.
Good on you, Thea. Now, that leads us to Legends of Tomorrow, which was an episode that took place in the 1980s, 1987 to be specific, and I love this one. Thought it was.
Oh, of course you did. With your given your affinity for Miami Vice, I'm not surprised that you love this.
Yes, I would certainly concur with others that I've seen that praise this episode for its humor, its period piece nature. The 80s was just an ideal time to go to. A lot of Miami Vice references, a lot of great 80s references in general. Mick Rory continues to be one of the best parts of the show this season.
Which is shocking given how bland he was towards the beginning of season one and kind of has gradually become one of the show's best characters.
Best characters, yeah. His interactions with Ray Palmer are outstanding. He's an essential part of the team at this point. He, Ray, and Sarah are really the essential members of the team. Good moments with Martin Stein. Good moments all around. I thought it was a really funny episode, a really good episode, and particularly enjoying the blossoming evil friendship between Damian Dark and the Reverse Flash. Still interested to see what the Reverse Flash's game is. So very, very interesting stuff. I enjoyed the hell out of this one.
Yeah, I did as well. I especially enjoyed the usage of Lance Henriksen as an elderly Obsidian in this one, and a little bit more of a glimpse into you know, the history of the JSA in the DC CW universe. So yeah, I thought this one was a big step in the right direction after probably the series, or the season, I should say, his worst episode last week. Unfortunately, looks like we got Jonah Hex coming in to ruin all of that for us next week.
Yeah. Which, we should be clear, for those that don't know, is not an indictment on Jonah Hex, who we love.
No.
It's an,
indictment on the actor.
The actor playing Jonah Hex, who we don't
And, like. Honestly, probably the writing of the character on this show.
Yes. Somebody needs to tie these people down, including the actor, and make them watch a bunch of Clint Eastwood westerns. And then maybe it could be fixed. But in any event, I will say it was a great episode. I love, again, what they did with Obsidian's powers. Really cool, to the point where I don't know how likely it is, but I would love to see Obsidian come back as a more permanent fixture on the show.
Yeah, I would imagine that it wouldn't be able to be Lance Henriksen.
It would have to be the younger version.
Yeah, he's got a little bit of a higher profile, so perhaps they could use, you know, time displaced younger version or something. Not that they're looking to add any more CW shows, but if they were, man, I really think a period piece about the JSA could be
wonderful.
Be really, really interesting. But I know that's highly, highly unlikely. So,
and now let's lead into The Walking Dead. AMC's The Walking Dead, episode 4 of the new season. This is our second, well, no, our third now. Our third real look at Negan. You know, pretty much all the episodes except one have included heavy doses of Negan. And all for the better, in my opinion. This was another stellar episode of this season. They're really, really firing on all cylinders right now. This was Negan comes to Alexandria to collect his bounty, essentially. And really, what it was really about is Negan further asserting his dominance and really sending, as if the last message that he sent by brutally murdering Abraham and Glenn wasn't enough, he's sending yet another message that he's the man now and that Rick does what he says and when he says it. And so does the rest of the town. Essentially, his mandate to Rick is that Rick needs to get everybody in the town on the same page as he is, or else they're going to suffer for it.
Yep.
And that's pretty much the premise of this episode. And again, another strong episode. Jeffrey Dean Morgan kills it as Negan. He is.
You know, you and I are loving this portrayal of Negan, but I have read a lot of reviews that a lot of people are not as high on this as we are. A lot of people are saying that the character of Negan isn't intimidating, he's just annoying, and that the dialogue, because it's seeking to be so charismatic and so comedic at times with the black comedy, that it comes off as just a little bit too much for the show's grounded take, and that it's not working for a lot of reviewers, it would seem, and I couldn't disagree more.
I couldn't disagree more. I honestly don't care. I mean, quite frankly, the idea of someone suggesting that the dialogue in the show is not appropriate for the grounded take that they're going for would make me question if they've ever actually read the comic book before.
Well, we haven't either, so we can't, you know.
No, we have read the comic book, Nick.
Well, I mean, but not you know.
But we've this read. Era of would comic. You agree that the dialogue in the comic book that we've read to the point that we've read it would not reflect a realistic, grounded take?
Yes, I would. I would greatly agree with that.
So, I mean, it's just laughable to me. But no, this is it's great to me. He has been a revelation. He has breathed life back into the show that it was arguably lacking at times last season. I think this, to this point, in my opinion, is their strongest season since way back in probably season 4. And hopefully they can continue it. But I dug this, man. I don't know about you, but I dug the episode.
Yeah, I liked it a great deal. I do think it was a little bit bloated. I don't think it needed to be 90 minutes.
No, I
think
I
could have told the same story in a standard runtime. But, you know, that's a minor complaint. And I will also say, everything's going great. And once again, leave it to Carl to screw everything up. Negan should have beaten his brains in right then and there, in my opinion.
Well, I would have. you know, I would have been probably preferred if he had beaten Rick's brains out myself, but that's just me. Anyway, it was a good episode. I have a few questions about it, though, Nick, and maybe you can help me out here.
Yes.
The foremost question in my mind is what in the double hockey sticks was the significance of Michonne seeing that smoke thing? I didn't understand that. Maybe I must have missed something, but you know, she's standing out there and she sees something in the distance and she walks over and appears to be a pile of smoking rubble and she begins breathing heavily and sweating profusely. And I'm not entirely sure what that was.
Those were the mattresses that the Saviors took.
Alexandria. Okay, yeah, I never got...
Showing they didn't actually want the mattresses, they were just fucking with them.
Yeah, it's kind of like when the guy took the bottle of water from Rosita and dumped it out for no good reason. Yes.
Slight, yes.
So, okay, I get that then. What do you think Rosita is plotting to do with one bullet?
Kill Negan,
yes, that's what I thought as well. Do you think this will end up well for her?
No, God, she's going to die. Lord, good Lord, is she going to die?
Yeah. And instead of her,
brutal fashion, probably.
Instead of her, it should be that guy that she went out with on the
Spencer.
Thing. Spencer,
the worst.
Spencer's the worst.
The absolute worst. Yeah.
Now that we've gotten all that established, well, let's rank the shows for the week, the DC shows or the CW shows anyway. I don't really think it's fair to compare to Walking Dead. It's kind of its own separate doohickey. So I am going at number three, I am going to go with Supergirl. At number two, Legends. And at number one, Arrow.
Same.
All right. Well, that brings an end to this segment. And when we come back from the break, we have got one of our favorite editions of Countdown. You're going to want to listen to this, folks, because Ben Morse is going to be here. He's one of the most interesting people to talk to about comics. So he'll be joining us to count down our favorite Marvel video games of all time. Did your favorites make the cut? Stay tuned to find out. And in the meantime, where's me fucking belt?
Promotional consideration paid for by the following...
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here. I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Left Is from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including a full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
You don't know me, and you don't know what I'm capable of. Badasses! Badasses! Everybody knows, wants to know where I've been.
Shut up, man.
You are right there. Get my bag!
Shine my shoes if I want to.
You damn right he's nice. I'm gonna show Kurt Angle.
I'm saddled to your dumb redneck ass. I'm doing him an egg.
Get in. You can get my room number if you want.
Bad asses. Bad asses. Bad asses.
You come out here and try to get the sympathy of the people, but you don't get my sympathy at all.
You fucking suck! They don't have to wait for the Earth to rotate at a 47-degree axis so the stars can touch the sky and create an equinox so they can see the Big Dipper.
I've wrestled a lot of countries.
Bad asses! Bad asses! Bad asses!
Chance of winning. I got a 66 and two-thirds chance of winning. You take your 33 and a third chance minus my 25% chance, and you got an 8 and a third chance of winning. But then you take my 75% chance of winning, and it adds 66 and two-thirds percent. I got 141 and two-thirds chance of winning.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation pop listeners. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, of course, and this is a special occasion. We are finally, after much ado, after much build, after much suspense, we are finally going to be joined for the very first time by a longtime member of the Place to Be Nation family, a Marvel higher-up who we will let you explain his title in a minute, someone we've been wanting to have on the show for a while, really excited to have him, Ben Morse. Welcome to the show, sir.
Yes, yes, finally, I'm here on the premier comic book podcast, A Place to Be Nation. It's been quite a road, guys, but thanks for bearing with me. This is truly a special, incredible, momentous occasion. I don't think any of us will ever be the same again. The PTBN pop landscape has now changed forever. This incredible meeting of the mega powers that are the hard-traveling fanboys and Ben Morse Two great tastes that taste great together. Happy to be here.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. And you know, I feel like for a lot of the time, our show is in the stratosphere, but perhaps this will be the one to take us to the ionosphere, brother.
Oh, yeah. No question. The ionosphere was the goal I set for myself when I came here tonight, and by God, we will reach the ionosphere.
May the internet connection gods be damned if they try to get in our way.
Yeah.
Yes, as you might be able to hear right now, we're having some technical issues tonight that are trying to conspire against us, trying to make sure that Ben remains a Sellers Point exclusive. We're not going to let that happen.
No. We've got the finest in internet surge protection now working hard to make sure that our voices are beamed directly into your skulls.
Go.
I'll the plot of Batman Forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show today, folks, we are counting down the top five video games based on Marvel Comics properties. Now, this runs the gamut from the terrible to the great. We're talking about the cream of the crop today. And it goes back all the way to the early 80s to games that I don't even remember existing or didn't ever know existed. But what we want to do is kind of, from all our three perspectives, talk about the games that impacted us the most. You know, maybe not necessarily the most influential or what have you, but the ones that speak the most to us and the ones that we have the most fond memories of. And one of the questions I want to ask everybody here is, what is the first Marvel game that you can remember playing? Ben, I'm going to start with you. What was the first Marvel game you remember playing?
I very distinctly and vividly remember playing Spider-Man for Atari. I was one of the few who had an Atari back in the day. When all my friends had Nintendo, I was still on my Atari. So I was, you know, making it proud. And the Spider-Man game was beautiful and frustrating at the same time. You were trying to climb to the top of a building. You were scaling up the side of a skyscraper. You could use your webs to swing from side to side because you had bad guys throwing things out the window at you. I don't know if they were bombs or fruit or whatever they were. But you were trying to get to the top where you got to fight the Green Goblin. I made it a couple of times, but like most Atari games, and anyone out there who's listening to me who played Atari can relate, it was incredibly simple, yet incredibly difficult. That was like the trademark of Atari. Like, you would have to do something that on the surface seems so easy, like climbing a building or walking into a room or running across a field. And it seemed incredibly easy, but it was impossible to do. And that's why I got to give the people who created Atari credit. They really knew how to make us work as kids.
I feel like your crossing a field and entering a room comments are aimed directly at E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Oh yeah, that was one of them.
Yeah, I had an Atari as well, and I remember that fondly. Those borderline unplayable games. I remember the day the NES finally entered our home, and it was like a revolution.
No, it's like, yeah, taking place. These games are so easy. I was like, these Nintendo kids have had it so easy this whole time. They weren't raised tough like me on Atari on games you couldn't win. They had Duck Hunt where you could just hold the gun up to the screen. You know, they didn't know the difficulties of playing I can't remember. I remember playing freaking Strawberry Shortcake, my sister's game on Atari. I couldn't even win at that. It was impossible.
And then you played the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game for NES, and all your complaints about the lack of difficulty went away.
Oh, God, that was a hard one.
Yeah, that's interesting. I vaguely remember playing the Atari. Like, we had, like, the boxing game for the Atari that was, you know, at the time seemed amazing, but maybe in hindsight, not so much. But the first Marvel game I remember playing was actually the NES Uncanny X-Men game from 89 that was like a top-down – I don't even know how to describe this game, because even when I was a kid – and I was 5 years old, and so I thought anything comic book related was cool. But all I remember about this game is just being like, really? That's it?
Yeah, like, it's so lame.
It's so corny. Like,
so lame.
You're like –
would it be – was it kind of like the – was it kind of like the overworld parts of that TMNT game I just mentioned? Because you remember –
yeah.
That one had an overworld where
that's
it was
exactly
top down.
What it was like.
Yep.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where the characters were just kind of little balls. You couldn't really distinguish what they were doing.
Yep.
Yeah. The way I remember you told them apart. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it was basically using the powers were supposed to be different because I think you had Iceman, Cyclops, Storm, and Wolverine.
And Nightcrawler.
Was Wolverine not even in it?
I don't think Wolverine was in it.
He may have been on the cover. But I was so excited because I was a huge Iceman fan to find a game that had Iceman in it, and then all you basically do is shoot like a little line of white that didn't freeze anything. It looked very much like something else, which, you know.
Yeah, it was not. You're right. Everything was just little like beams that would, I guess, disintegrate the opponent or whatever.
Yeah.
But it just the worst, like so bad, to the point that like it, you know, I'm surprised they ever made another one after that because it was so bad. But I remember that one, and then I vaguely remember playing the Silver Surfer game, I think, but I don't
never
remember
played
anything
that.
I don't remember anything about it. I just know that it existed, and I probably played it at some point. Nick, what was the first Marvel game for you?
I'm fairly sure it was the Spider-Man arcade game.
That was actually
Which I never knew existed, by the way. I literally found out that existed by researching for this episode.
Yeah, I remember we used to make trips to the local mall to go shopping or whatever, and I remember, because my brother is much older than I am, and so I think we took him to go, like, school shopping or something like that, and I was, you know, maybe four, and so back in the day, back in the 90s, you know, parents would just turn their kids loose in a public place and not really worry about things like that.
The good old days.
Yeah, in the good old days. So, and they, like, the arcade had little step stools for the kids who couldn't reach the controls or whatever. And so I
arcades were designed for kids who had been abandoned by their parents.
Hey, that's exactly what they were.
Not like today.
And it was great because the arcade was in the direct center of the mall, and it had dual entrances. So one end led to the food court, and the other end led to, like, the actual, you know, shopping area. So it was perfectly designed. But I remember they had this one, and I think they might have had that Punisher one as well at the time, but I can't remember.
The Punisher Nick Fury one?
Yeah, the Punisher Nick Fury one, but I know I played the hell out of the Spider-Man arcade game back in the day, and I'm fairly sure that was my first one. I can't remember playing any of the old NES games, and the first console experience I remember having was probably X-Men on the Genesis, but...
speaking of hard games, but contrast the Spider-Man arcade game and how awesome it was versus the X-Men Nintendo game and how bad it was... Iceman's powers were so underwhelming on the X-Men game, but then you had Namor in the Spider-Man game who could shoot lightning bolts, and it was the coolest that Namor has ever been, because he could fry people from, like, across the screen. And I was like, oh my god. And then when I actually read a comic that Namor was in, and I think I waited probably about 5 years before I realized he was never going to throw a lightning bolt. That was a contrivance that the people who made the video games came up with to make him because they all need to be able to shoot something. Because that was the thing about video game characters back in the day, is they all had to be equal. They all had to have the same abilities. Yes. So, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. No,
well, don't feel too bad about your Namor misconceptions. I've been going back and reading a lot of the early Fantastic Four via the wonderful Marvel Unlimited app, and I keep waiting for Namor
to become... The Webby Award-winning Marvel Unlimited app?
The wonderful, absolutely worth every penny Marvel Unlimited app. But anyway, I keep waiting for Namor to become an evil movie producer like he was in an early issue of Fantastic Four again.
Namor's the best.
Yes, S&M Studios was a good touch back in the 60s.
Speaking of being, you know, misled by the video games, I spent years wondering why Nick Fury wasn't the Punisher's sidekick. Based on the arcade game.
Yeah, right.
But with all that said, I actually neglected to properly give you an introduction, Ben. Tell the people out here what you do for Marvel Comics.
I am Marvel's editorial director of digital media, which means if it's digital media, if it's a story on the website, if it's a podcast, if it's a video, if it's a live stream, if it's anything done digitally over the web, I had something to do with it. Maybe not a lot to do with it, but at some point I had something to do with it. That's how I like to sell it. It's a nice title.
And does that include the Webby Award-winning Marvel Unlimited app?
I have consulted extensively on the Webby Award-winning Marvel Unlimited and use it as a fan as well. It's like the Hair Club for Men. I'm not just the president. I'm also a client. I love Marvel Unlimited.
It is truly fantastic. I'm not just blowing smoke here. I think it is going to revolutionize the way comics are marketed and consumed at some point.
It is the WWE network of comics, basically, if you're a wrestling fan tuning in.
It's amazing. And especially if you get the annual subscription price, there is no better value on the face of this planet than this.
And also, you can hear more about how great it is each and every week here on the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history.
That one was much better done as we got going along.
That was good.
It took us a little while.
Yeah. You guys got some real momentum there. It was nice. It was beautiful.
Yeah, we're actually kind of upset that, I don't know if you noticed, but on Raw this week, Jericho and Owens were stealing our thunder of, you know, saying things in unison. That's our gimmick.
Oh, man.
That's our gimmick. Yeah, I think we have a claim to it.
Yeah, it's probably where they got it from.
That's exactly right. And I also would like to take umbrage with some of the things that Chris Jericho was saying a couple months ago from this date in November, we're all listening to this, when Chris Jericho referred to he and Kevin Owens as the best friends in the world, because clearly hard traveling fanboys are the best friends in the world. But all that's beside the point. Ben also has a history with me. When I was a college student at Troy University, I actually was writing a research paper about the influence of Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen. Ben was writing for the website 411 Mania in the comic section at that time. I actually emailed Ben to see if he would help me out, offer some quotes up for my research paper. He was kind enough to do it, helped me out a ton, and I aced the paper. Yeah. So thanks for that, Ben.
And we got to bring that paper back, man. We got to get that up on Place to Be Nation. It's more relevant than ever.
Absolutely. I'm gonna find it. I'm gonna do my best to get a hold of that and get it uploaded for all the public to view. But in the meantime, we're gonna get cracking on our lists here in just a second. But one more thing that I wanted to throw out there: some of these games that I had never heard of. I never knew there was a Spider-Man arcade game until I did research for this article. I never knew there was a Wolverine NES game. Does anyone remember anything about that?
Yep. Yeah,
I remember the box art, and that's it, because the box art was modeled after the classic Miller and Claremont
cover. The Come and Get Me cover. I don't remember ever playing the Wolverine video game for NES, but I remember seeing the advertisement in, like, every comic that I bought for months.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, I remember X-Men 2 Clone Wars, but I did not remember that there was like an SNES counterpart to it that was – what was the name of it? X-Men God, what was the name of it?
I was a Genesis guy, so I did not
know. I was a Genesis guy too, and now I'm not finding it on here. But anyway, it was –
was it Something Apocalypse? Was it the Rise of Apocalypse?
Yeah, Something Apocalypse. Yep, yeah, something like that. Yep. Yeah, so just a litany of games that now I really want to go back and play if I could only find my old systems. But
just become a video game hoarder like me and never let go of your old systems. I have all mine still.
Well, I wish I had. I think I have my old ones. I just don't have access to them, sadly enough. But the way we're going to work it is we're going to start out at number 5 as usual and count our way down. And since Ben is our guest, I say we start with him. What is your number 5 Marvel video game of all time, sir?
My number 5 Marvel video game of all time. Now, I did eventually get an SNES, so I can't remember whether – I think this was for Genesis, but it might have been for SNES. But my number 5 is Captain America and the Avengers.
Nice.
It was a classic side-scroller. It was in the vein of something like Double Dragon or something like that. You could play as Captain America. You could play as Iron Man. You could play as Vision. You could play as Hawkeye. For me, the coolest thing as a kid was just getting to play as characters who I never thought I'd get to play as. I mean, even Captain America and Iron Man, you have to remember, this is for people who are, you know, listening now, this was a world without the Marvel movies. So, you know, everyone knew who the X-Men were. Everyone knew who Spider-Man was. You had some idea who Captain America and Iron Man were. There was no chance in hell you had any idea who Hawkeye or Vision were unless you were reading the comic books. So to get to play as Hawkeye, who was one of my favorite characters, was awesome. And the graphics were really slick for the time. I think it had been adapted from an arcade game. I think it was an arcade game to begin with, and they ported it down to Genesis and SNES. Like I was saying before, how, you know, every character has to have the same powers. So they had kind of the absurdity of Captain America having his shield, Iron Man having an energy shield, and then Hawkeye just holding his bow in front of him,
somehow
deflecting power blasts. But this had, like, it had great cameos. It had the Wasp, it had Wonder Man. It had every Avengers villain you could think of.
A deep roster of villains.
Yes. It was a long game. I mean, you would get all the way to, like, the big ones like Ultron and the Mandarin, and Red Skull was the ultimate boss of the game, but you had guys like the Melter in there, you had Crossbones in there. It was fun. So to me, it probably wasn't a great technical masterpiece, but when I think back to my youth, I remember playing the hell out of that game, and I just remember thinking it was so cool that, you know, friggin' Vision was in a game and got to use his forehead blast back when no one had any idea where it was. So that's my number 5.
And I'm going to go ahead and jump in here because my number 5 is also Captain America and the Avengers.
Yeah, woohoo!
this was actually probably my first exposure to the Avengers as characters. Because
mine too.
Yeah, I lived in a rural area where we didn't really – like if we got comics at the local grocery store, it was like maybe three or four books. And so it was pretty much, you know, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, the X-Men, and that was it. So I had no clue who most of these characters were, especially the Vision, because this game featured him in his all-white attire rather than the classic
red, green, and yellow
look. So very unique look for the Vision in this one. And I distinctly remember for some reason – the levels of this game, the flying levels, where you were either Iron Man or the Vision actually flying through the sky, or you were Captain America or Hawkeye riding on like this hover cycle thing.
You get a sky. They used to be called sky sleds.
Sky sleds. There you go. Yeah, but I remember those levels being my favorite throughout the game. I don't know that I actually ever beat it in all my years, but I loved playing this. And yes, it was on Genesis. I distinctly remember. I was one of the privileged few who had both the Genesis and an SNES. And I played this one on Genesis all the time.
Yeah, that was one. I don't think I ever actually owned it, but I would get my parents to rent it for me like every weekend. Especially like if like I would do chores, and instead of an allowance, I would say, "Can I rent a video game this Friday night?" And that would be one that I would just rent constantly.
Yeah,
and so much fun. And I was an X-Men kid, so I mainly for Marvel stuff. I mainly read X-Men and like random crap like Ghost Rider and stuff like that, but. So I never really read any of the Avengers books, so it was,
that was the thing.
Cool to me to be able to play as all of them together.
Yeah, the thing you have to remember, and that is like inconceivable now when the Avengers is this multi-billion-dollar blockbuster movie and you know who all the characters were, is that no kids read the Avengers when we were kids, you know? Like, no one did. They had a title somehow that had survived since the 60s, but no one grew up as an Avengers kid. Everyone was X-Men. Or Spider-Man, or some combination of the two. If you read Marvel Comics, like those were the ones you read. Like the Avengers were not cool; they were not cool characters. So it was kind of neat that this video game actually was one of the first. It was ahead of its time because it recognized the coolness of those characters. And you see today in the movies and TV and everything, obviously they were characters who had a lot of potential.
Yeah, and I distinctly remember as a kid being like, you know, my first exposure to Iron Man as a character. I was like, holy crap, it's a character dressed in all red and yellow, and he seems awesome.
Yeah.
Because that was what spoke to me as a kid at the time, being the massive Hogan fan that I was. So I played Iron Man, I'm pretty sure, like 95% of the time when I was playing that game.
He looked so cool, too. It was just a cool
design. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I was a Hawkeye guy on the Avengers game. I was a big... big fan of playing as him, but I guess I'll go ahead and move on to my number five, which actually has been mentioned already briefly in conversation. The 1993 Punisher arcade game, which they also did a Genesis port of, but and I played that as well. But to me, it couldn't capture the magic of just walking into an arcade in the mid 90s and seeing a kid playing this video game and. Probably inappropriate in hindsight, but playing a video game where you just pick up guns and just murder dudes in the street with the Punisher and walking up to him and saying, "Do you mind if I put this quarter in?" And him saying, "Nah," and I put the quarter in. And this was like a weekend routine. And then we would just, two kids who had never met each other, would sit there and communicate and have fun and play this Punisher game for hours.
Communicate through the language of violence.
The language, the universal language of murder. And so I just loved everything about this game. I love that you could just pick up the bad guy's weapons when they dropped them and use them to murder them with, which was an old Double Dragon thing, but it was a lot cooler in this game. And I loved the Kingpin. Like, I thought he was admittedly, when I was a kid, basically all they gave me was, "He's fat!" to paraphrase Mr. Steiner. That's all I needed. He's fat, he's bald, and he's mean looking, so I need to shoot him. And so, but this game was just super fun, like picking up pipes and beating guys with them or picking up different types of guns. And it was hard because it was designed to suck up as much money from you as it possibly could.
As all arcade games were.
And you had to, you actually had to work with your teammate to help each other out and stuff. And it was just a fun time to be a kid and a fun time to be a video game fan. And I kind of missed that experience of kids getting to kind of interact in person as opposed to over the internet. So because of nostalgic reasons, admittedly, this gets on my list. But also just because I haven't played it in a long time, but I feel like it would hold up pretty well compared to some of its competitors. So the Punisher is my number five.
I gotta ask, Ben, being the Marvel aficionado of the group, is there any sort of like precedent for the Punisher having Nick Fury as his sidekick?
None whatsoever. The only interaction Nick Fury has ever had with the Punisher, to the best of my knowledge, is trying to arrest him. They are polar opposites as far as everything. I mean, they're both soldiers, so it made sense, and it's kind of cool to see Nick Fury in a video game back in the 90s. But no, definitely there was no logical tie from the comics to get these two together. Nick Fury is a law enforcement professional, and Frank Castle is essentially a vigilante.
Yeah, and one of the things that I forgot to mention that is one of my favorite things about this game is the cutscenes. I don't know if you guys played this much at all, but this game had the coolest cutscenes to that point I had ever seen in an arcade game, because it would be like these really like cinematic, like widescreen, like confrontations between, whether it be this dialogue between the Punisher and Nick Fury, where Fury is kind of questioning the Punisher's motives and everything. And as you know, Nick, we love it when people question each other's motives. And you know, so whether it would be that, or whether it would be the Kingpin like ominously threatening someone, or it had really cool cutscenes for the time that almost made it feel like Ninja Gaiden or one of those one of the Japanese style NES games. So I just really enjoyed this one. Understandably, it probably won't appear in any of the lists, but but that's my number five. Ben, any memories of this one? Or are you ready for your number four?
I did not play a lot of Punisher. Actually, my co-host on my podcast that I do for Marvel, This Week in Marvel, Ryan Penagos, who's Agent M on Twitter, he was the big Punisher fan out of the two of us. So when we record our podcast tomorrow, I'm going to ask him about it and see if he ever played this. I remember it existing, and I, like you guys, my most distinct memory of it is that player two was Nick Fury. I think that's like what the game was most known for. But I never really played it that much.
Also, I'm looking at a screenshot right now, and I don't remember Nick Fury having a hideous brown outfit, but apparently he did. So what's your number four, Ben?
I'm moving along to my number four, creeping a little bit along. I'm slowly moving through time here. My number four was Spider-Man Maximum Carnage.
Holy crap, Ben. Are we going to have the same list?
The exact same list?
No, I also have Spider-Man Maximum Carnage.
Spider-Man Maximum Carnage, which came with the red cartridge that you could pop into your SNES, and that great computer shot of Carnage looting over the city. It was cool because not only was it a great game, the gameplay was awesome. You could play as Spider-Man or Venom. You had a whole assortment of random-ass allies to choose from. But it was the first – I could be wrong on this, but – I think it was the first game that adapted a comic book storyline pretty directly. And I remember, like, it's
down to the actual panels as the cutscenes. Like,
they would use panels of cutscenes. I mean, it was very much like Death and Return of Superman for DC, where they got the whole story in there. So if you were a fan of Maximum Carnage, the story in comics, and most kids in the 90s were, you could actually play through the story that you remembered. So that was what made it so distinct for me. I thought it was so cool. And that's why you get and I always remember the team-ups. The X-Men Genesis game was good about team-ups, and this was good about team-ups, that you could get a little thing with, like, Firestar's face on it and use Firestar to burn all these people alive. And I remember also that it proudly displayed that his soundtrack was by Green Jelly.
Green jelly.
Yep. That's it. I was going to say toxic jelly. No. But green jelly. That's right.
I have no idea who Green Jelly are, other than they were the band for. Cause that was like a prestige point that they made sure to advertise, was this game has its own soundtrack by none other than Green Jelly, which
I'm
was
pretty
just phenomenal.
Sure right after the Marvel and Nintendo logos on the SNES game,
it said
the
Green
next
Jelly.
Logo that popped up was Green Jelly, which was like a skull and crossbones with a green blob in the middle or something like that.
At the time, I think I thought it was Green Day, because that was right around the time that they were coming out and being and having big names. I also vividly remember Cloak and Dagger, who I had never encountered in the comics and seemed so lame, but I would use them all the time in the games.
Oh, Cloak, they were great. This is still like the best usage of Cloak in anything ever, because it's pretty much an instant win button.
You had
bring up Cloak.
You had Cloak and Dagger, you had Captain America, you had Deathlock, you had Iron Fist, you had Morbius.
Black Cat.
It's because they were all in Maximum Carnage, because Maximum Carnage was such a huge story. It just encompassed so much that it was just so cool to be able to turn on a game and, like you said, see those cutscenes or see those allies or see the villains. You had to fight all the villains from Maximum Carnage. You had to fight Demo Goblin. You had to fight Carrion. You had to fight Shriek before you finally got to Carnage. So I think Maximum Carnage deserves to be on the list just for historical value. I just because it was, to me, the first game that really adapted a story and did a great job of it. It was super fun to play. And then it had a sequel called Separation Anxiety, which was super disappointing and just not nearly as good as the first one.
Absolutely. Nick it also had tons of... tons of replay value because it had a branching storyline. You could actually go back and replay, you know, certain sections of the game as either Spider-Man or Venom, but based on who you played as in your first playthrough to get the entire experience. Not that that ever mattered for me, because I still don't think to this day I've ever actually beaten the game. It is one of the more challenging video game experiences of my life.
It was super hard.
Specifically, every time I think I'm doing really well on it, I'll be cruising through the game and get to the Fantastic Four, the Baxter Building level, and that pretty much destroys all my lives at that point, because you wind up fighting that giant security robot or whatever, and you pretty much, you know, it's over at that point. And if you get through it, you have so few lives left, there's no way you're going to make it through the end of the game.
So hard. Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it to sound like the old man that I'm becoming, but as we move through time with these games, like, that's the thing. Is like, I can beat a game today. I mean, that could also have something to do with being in my 30s and having as much time to play as I want, as opposed to, you know, my mom coming in the room and telling me to go eat dinner. And also the fact that we can sit. Kids don't realize what a luxury the save and continue options on video games are.
Oh, my God, yes.
I mean, it used to be you just had to devote a whole Saturday to win a video game.
Pray nobody touch the reset button.
Yeah, and now I sound like I'm about to yell at kids to get off my lawn or something, so I'm going to stop. But Maximum Carnage, awesome game.
Yeah, Nick and I were talking earlier today, though. Was there ever an occasion in which you actually picked Spider-Man instead of Venom? Because we were both Venom guys on the game.
If ever given the option to play as Spider-Man or Venom, it was Venom for me.
Yeah, no, everyone wanted to play as Venom. He had much cooler powers. That's just the way it was.
Could choke slam guys into the wall and stuff. I mean,
so that's your number four as well, Nick?
Yeah, I also have Spider-Man Maximum Carnage at number four for all the reasons Ben just listed. I mean, like I said, Captain America and the Avengers was kind of my first exposure to the Avengers characters, and for me... all these cameos that Ben was calling out, that was my first exposure to a lot of those characters, whether it was Cloak and Dagger or Firestar or, you know, Captain America, obviously I knew, Black Cat, I had a little bit of knowledge of, I think, based on the cartoon, which was out at that point. But, you know, for the most part, it just started to expand my knowledge of the Marvel Universe as a kid at a time when access to such things was very, very limited.
I remember it was a big deal for me that Firestar was in the game, because I was a huge New Warriors mark. Like, that was my comic. That was my favorite comic when I was a kid. So just, like, the fact that, you know, I expected Nova or Night Thrasher to show up in a video game before Firestar. This is before I even knew what Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends were. For some reason, even though I was around the right age to watch Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, I never did. I didn't even know it existed. But to see Firestar in the game, I was like, oh, that's so cool.
Strangely enough, I made my mom buy me a VHS from Walmart of, like, some Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends episodes based on this game. So I was like, oh, it's Firestar. She's in that game, and there's Spider-Man. This ought to be awesome. And it was... a somewhat unique experience, some might say.
It's a vicious cycle. It's the vicious cycle of comics consumerism. Always trying to get hooked for more.
Yep. And I tend to fall for it more often than most, I think.
Well, speaking, I led off with an arcade game, and I am going to follow with an arcade game as my number four entrant. It is the classic X-Men arcade game. Which, in the interest of full disclosure, I always assumed was made in the 80s, but apparently didn't come out until 1992, even though it was based on Pride of the X-Men, which came out in 89.
It was so much a fuller experience once you finally watch Pride of the X-Men. and understood that this was like this video game was part of a bigger world that that Marvel was trying to create. It's so much extra. But I won't take it. I won't take your spot talking about it. But I just like I didn't get Pride of the X-Men probably till I was a teenager. I got it off eBay and I watched it and I was like, holy shit! It's the X-Men arcade game. And just finally, just like putting the pieces together, finally years later, understanding why that particular roster of X-Men were in a video game together, it was just like my mind was absolutely blown. I was like, oh my God, it finally makes sense.
Yeah, and it also helps you to just visualize and to hear Wolverine's Australian accent.
Yes.
Oh, kids! although what was up with the inclusion of Dazzler? I don't even think she was in Pride of the X.
Well, not just the inclusion of Dazzler, but making Dazzler like the most badass character in the game. Yeah, what was up with that?
She was in Pride of the X-Men because they needed a female character in the X-Men, and for some reason they didn't, or they needed another female character because they had Storm, but they didn't have any other women.
Kitty Pryde was in Pride of the X-Men,
but she was just like the new. You needed like when they were going to make the action figures, you needed enough female characters. You were trying to get girls
like an established
to watch.
X-Men.
Dazzler was definitely in Pride of the X-Men.
So they have you basically have Cyclops, Colossus, Wolverine, Storm, Dazzler, and Nightcrawler. And these are your characters that you had to choose from. And the way that the arcade was set up is you had, like, a joystick, basically, for each character. So you basically would come in, and whoever you wanted to play as, you'd put the quarter in that slot, and you'd play as that character. And basically, this was like a comic book fan's, you know, dream come to life in the early 90s. Like, how many times did you as a kid show up to the arcade and there's two or three kids playing the X-Men game and hell yeah, I'm going to join in on that. And like for me, I was about Colossus on this game. I would always want to play as Colossus every single time, even though he had the weird power where he would explode his skin.
The power spark.
Yeah.
They called it. Yeah.
And then that would regrow again. But the, but this was just a fun beat 'em up side-scrolling game like there were in the early 90s, much like the Punisher game, but with more characters, with the true-to-life X-Men villains on the game, Blob, Toad, etc.
Sentinels were the same size as you.
Yes.
That was weird.
Normal-sized Sentinels. Like a better version of Pride of the X-Men, essentially. So, although my
which isn't saying much, you should probably give it a little higher praise than a better version of Pride.
Although it did lack a Stan Lee voiceover, which I could have
That would have been great. The other thing you have to mention is that because it was six player, just the way the joysticks were positioned, I think it was if you played as Cyclops or Dazzler, and I liked playing as Cyclops, you would be so crouched up against the screen, you had to like crane your neck over to try to see what the fuck was going on.
Yep.
But it didn't matter. It was so awesome. Such an awesome experience.
Oh, no. It just so much fun. And I still remember the jubilation the first time I was with the group that beat the game.
Yep.
And admittedly, I joined in late. I'm not going to claim to
have been there the whole time. No, that's fine. That's how everyone won that game. It was always it was always just a matter of basically if you were leaving the arcade and your character died, you wanted someone to start up before the continue ran out.
Right.
Because you just wanted that was the ultimate in team building.
Absolutely. And just like I remember high-fiving kids that I never saw before or after that day because we beat the game. We actually freaking beat it. And it was just so much fun. And I downloaded the remake that they put out, I guess, on
PS3. The emulator. Yep.
Yeah, the emulator version. And it's fun, but it's not the same when there's not when you have unlimited continues, basically.
Right.
Like, it's still really fun, but there's just something about the magic of, you know.
Well, I would imagine it's not as fun playing. This is one of the few things that's not as fun playing in the comfort of your home.
Right.
Because you really want that communal feel.
Mm-hmm. That feeling of satisfaction when you.
Absolutely.
When you finally beat it. So this is an easy entry on my list. Nick, any thoughts on this? Or I'm assuming this will pop up later on yours.
It will not, actually. So, I mean, an awesome game. I think I probably didn't play it as much because I don't remember our arcade actually having it. I did play it a couple times, and I remember Dazzler always being, like, this seemingly overpowered character. Like, I've never found Dazzler as appealing as she ever was in that game. I enjoyed the game for sure, and I've probably actually played more of the remake that you just referenced than I did the actual arcade version, but I would agree it loses a little bit in the translation, but still it was an iconic arcade game.
Well, with all that being said, on to number three, Mr. Morse.
All right, let's see if we still have the same one going here. For number three, mine is the original Marvel vs. Capcom.
Okay, we have finally broken here.
There's a fork in the road.
That fork comes because Greg and I are both terrible at fighting games. So no Marvel versus Capcom.
Marvel versus Capcom was the premier, like, great fighting game, and from there it just got better and better. I mean, I think I don't know the exact history of the series. I think there was, like, X-Men games beforehand, and I just remember getting into this and playing with characters like Iron Man or Iceman, who just had these ridiculously overly elaborate special moves that you could do, and it wasn't that tough. And there was something about the mixture of also having the Capcom characters in there. I would never play as the Capcom characters. I'm only the Marvel characters.
Right.
I was just like, oh, this is so fun to beat these guys up. Like, to me, it was almost it was like the Capcom characters were the villains of the game, and the Marvel characters were the heroes, and you could only play as them. It might as well have been that way. But it was so much fun. The graphics were awesome to this day. I think they still hold up. The animation, there was so much work put into it. Even, like, the story, like, in fighting games, you give or take on the story, because at the end of the day, it's just a contrivance to try to get these characters in a place where they can go at it in hand-to-hand combat. But it was a pretty cool story, and it launched a great franchise, which is still going strong to this day. So I think historical value. I'm all about the historical value, just like I was with Maximum Carnage. I think this kicked off something really special.
Yeah, and it also was one of those arcade cabinets that would always be packed with people.
Oh yeah,
not just people playing, but people watching the people playing. And
right.
That was me, because I sucked so bad at it.
Yep,
I was that kid that would sit back and would watch the two good people play.
Yep. Yeah, there's always that aura of watching two kids who are really good at a fighting game play, but, like, you could not replicate. Like, that was always just the most mesmerizing thing to watch.
I
still periodically to this day watch a little bit of Evo, the fighting game championships, online whenever they come around, and it still blows my mind how the amount of skill it takes to master these games.
It reminds me of what it must have been like to, like, watch Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris fight on the set of the Dragon.
Just totally the same.
Totally,
well, absolutely the same.
Yes. And I wasn't very good at it, but I remember thinking it was just so cool to see it. The graphics were so good. And I think it was actually the sequel or the successor to X-Men versus Street Fighter. That came
from
that. And then I think the very first one that I actually did play was X-Men Children of the Atom, which I think was was done by Capcom.
Yeah.
And
the
reason I remember it was because it had Omega Red in it. And anyone who has talked to me about X-Men knows I am the world's most inexplicable mark for Omega. So just a great, great choice, Ben. Awesome choice, and one that I'm sure a lot of people out there are going to agree with. Nick?
So, hey, Ben, remind me, did this one have the 3v3 format from the get-go, or did that come along?
I think that came along later. I don't think it was 3v3 from the start. I could be wrong. It's been a long time since I played that game.
Yeah, that's what I most vividly remember about whichever version of the game I did play a little
bit.
Yeah,
you could pick your little team.
Your little team or whatever, so I was just curious. But speaking of picking teams, I'm going to go along to my number three, which is X-Men Legends. A outstanding game that I played on the GameCube, but also came out for the PlayStation 2 and I believe it was out on Xbox as well. I was out of the Xbox loop, so I can't confirm that. But this was a really cool game because it kind of brought a gauntlet-style dungeon crawler to the Marvel Universe. You had an expansive roster of X-Men. I mean, even as not a... I'm not someone who is a X-Men expert, you know, as they say, but the pulls they made for some of these characters was just outstanding. The ability to build your own team, to level up your characters, to combine powers together and pull off, you know, that game's version of stuff like the Cannonball Special or what have you. Still remember that to this day. And honestly, for a dungeon crawler, a pretty damn engaging story that was very, very well done and kind of, you know, set the template for bigger and better things to come that I'll get into a little bit later in my list. But, you know, X-Men Legends, I still remember it to this day. Strangely enough, even though she was the somewhat cheesy point of view character, I loved playing as Magma in the game.
Magma.
Because she had that attack where you could pound the ground and the giant, like, volcano thing came up, and you could send enemies flying and stuff. So, yeah.
She's overpowered, yeah.
Yeah, her and Wolverine were kind of the two that I just pretty much played as much as possible in that game. And I remember the awful standard enemy voices that just kept shouting things like die, mutie, and stuff like that every 5 seconds. But so much fun back in the day, and almost wish it would get a remaster, much like its successors, Ultimate Alliance, did later, because I think it'd be really fun to go back and revisit it in the era of expanded online multiplayer.
Yeah, this game kicked off a pretty great era for Marvel video games, and I loved that marriage of action and RPG that they did in this series. It was so much fun, and you remember, Nick, in college, how much fun it was. Well, I guess it was before you came along to Troy, but me and some of the Troy guys, we would gather at David Sunday, who's a listener of the show, at his dorm room, and we would play X-Men Legends sometimes just to pass the time, and it was always a fun way to pass time, always a fun game. Great to experiment with the different mutant abilities and build up different characters and stuff like that. Just a lot of fun. And like you said, really good. Here's the list of playable characters: Beast, Colossus, Cyclops, Emma Frost, Gambit, Iceman, Jean Grey, Jubilee, Magma, Nightcrawler, Professor X, Psylocke, Rogue, Storm, and Wolverine. Pretty good list of characters there. I never ever played as Jubilee, by the way.
I was just going to say, Jubilee's on the list. I would have no idea.
I don't think I ever played as Emma Frost either.
I played as Emma for
Frost
sure.
And Jubilee were the two that I kind of stayed away from.
Ben, any
Storm
memories?
Storm was awesome, though.
Yeah, Ben, any memories of X-Men Legends?
You know, I was kind of out of the video game loop when X-Men Legends came out. I don't remember playing it a lot. I definitely played it once or twice, but I remember Ultimate Alliance much more, and I'll talk about that in a little bit.
Ah, as will we all, I'm sure.
Yeah.
This game,
yeah.
X-Men Legends, also had a brief appearance by Moira McTaggart.
Voice did, yes.
Yeah, extreme Irish accent, as she should be in all
Scottish iterations. Scottish accent.
Scottish, I'm sorry. Yeah,
yeah.
Irish,
come
Scottish.
On, man.
They don't like each other. But
no.
Noam Dar is from Scotland, by the way, and I have a bone to pick with him. But that's another story for another time.
Rat bastard, Noam Dar.
That brings us to you, Nick. What is your selection? Actually, you just said your selection, number three.
Yeah, I was about to say.
My number three is Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2. Sequel to the original Marvel Ultimate Alliance, obviously. And this one made my list not so much for the story, because the story is basically a very, very loose adaptation of Civil War.
Very loose.
That,
very, very loose.
Is not particularly compelling in any way. And also ends in the most convenient, in an even more convenient fashion than the original Civil War ended. And so the story is not what gets this on this list. What gets this on its list is what I thought was a huge step up in gameplay from the X-Men Legends and Marvel Ultimate Alliance franchise. This introduced the idea of fusion attacks, which were awesome in my opinion. The it also expanded on the roster from the original and allowed you to do things that, like, you know, for anybody that's seen the event, everybody's seen the Avengers, the classic, you know, repeller blast off the shield. That is an actual move you can do in this game, and I remember in college us just sitting around, screwing around way too late and just experimenting with different combinations of powers that you could do on this game, how different characters would interact. So half the fun of this game wasn't even playing the missions. It was just experimenting with, mm-hmm. you know, different combinations like the Thing and Storm, or Iron Man and Thor, or Venom and Gambit together, you know, like just weird random combinations and seeing what their powers would do when they interacted. And also some really cool boss fights along the way. The RPG elements were simplified a little bit too much, in my opinion, in this one. They took away a little bit of the strategy element, mm-hmm. but it did make for a really fun, just, okay, I just got home from work, I have to be at work again in the morning, but let's stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning playing games because we're still in our mid-20s. So that was a lot of fun.
Ultimate Alliance 2 had the distinction of being one of the first video games I played start to finish with my wife. So that was just such a cool experience. Yep. I was already working at Marvel by the time it came out. So it was, you know, this is the home team. But she loves strategy games. She loves, like, the Mario games and stuff like that. So she got really into Ultimate Alliance 2. We played the whole thing through together. We never owned it. I think we just rented it. And we had such a blast. It was such a cool way to introduce someone who didn't really know Marvel characters to all these Marvel heroes and villains. So kudos to Alliance 2 for that one.
Absolutely, and yeah. I'll admit that it introduced me to some characters that I had not had any experience with. You know, mm-hmm. there were characters that would pop up, like A-Bomb. I had never heard of him as a villain, and, you know, just Songbird. I didn't know who Songbird was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who Penance was. So this game really introduced me to a lot of characters I had never heard of. And
thank God it introduced you to Penance.
Probably the most important.
You admitted
character.
You were a new Warriors mark earlier, so I was waiting for the reaction when he mentioned Penance.
Can't stand Penance. The worst.
And of course, everyone's favorite character, Nanite Nick Fury.
My god!
But no, I really loved this game for the fun that it gave, and I think there's a place for games like this that you can pick up and play with friends in your own home. And I don't think there's a lot of games being made like that anymore.
That's true.
You can just sit down and pick it up and play it. So,
yeah, I'll go ahead and say that, like, you know, I, being the huge Civil War mark that I am, I had major issues with the story, and I think it took me out of the experience, you know, the first couple times I played it. But I will admit it was a lot of fun to play, you know, with friends or whatever. And I specifically remember the Deadpool boss fight where he's making fun of the idea of a boss fight. I remember that being really, really cool. So, Ultimate Alliance 2 definitely, like you said, technically, from a technical standpoint, from a gameplay standpoint, improved upon its predecessor. But I can't say that I enjoyed it quite as much as the original.
Alrighty, and that brings us to the coveted number two spot on the countdown. Ben Morse, your number two, sir.
Could not ask for a better segue, as my number two is the original and superior Marvel Ultimate Alliance. It's a fantastic game. My story here is this game came out when I was working for Wizard Magazine, and we got a beta copy in before the game actually came out. And Wizard basically consisted of a bunch of guys in their 20s who all loved comic books. So we would gather in the boss's office after we finished work for the day. We so badly wanted to play this during the day, but they would just not let us. We had to be, you know, writing about comics, not playing video games about comics, unless you could contrive some way that, like, no, this is research for a story I'm doing, which happened more than once. But no, we would just, you know, there would be like 10 or 20 of us in the room taking turns wanting to play this game. Just the most immersive experience ever. Just took every dream you had as a kid of being able to be part of a Marvel story and just blew it out of the water. The cinematics were incredible. The graphics were incredible. The gameplay was incredible. But it was just that this is where I think the original beats up on the sequel. It's just you went everywhere. You went to every Marvel location. Yep. You encountered every Marvel character. It was just like they were chucking as many as they could. I think C.B. Sobolski worked on this game. And he's a great guy who's still at Marvel to this day. I think he had input on this. and it was just so much fun. And I remember at the time, my later wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, was living in an apartment with me, and I would just keep calling and be like, yeah, I'm going to be a little late at work today. Yeah, I'm going to be a little late at work today. Yeah, I'm going to be a little late at work today. It was just because we were playing Ultimate Alliance, and you just did not want to go home from work because you just wanted to stay and play Ultimate Alliance. And then when you eventually had to leave, you just hoped that the guys who were still there wouldn't stay that far after you because you didn't want to miss any levels of the game. It was just the most addictive experience, and I recently downloaded it. The bundle for Xbox One, and it's just as good. It's just such a good game. It's just the writing and the plotting and the mechanics that went into making this game are incredible, and they hold up to this day.
Yeah, and appropriately enough, I'm gonna jump in now because this is my number two as well.
Yay! All right.
I vividly remember this game coming out and blowing everyone's minds because we thought X-Men Legends was as good as it was gonna get.
Right, right. This was X-Men Legends on steroids.
Exactly. Yep. This was. That is exactly correct. This was the,
and it should be called out that this followed what a lot of people, kind of like Ultimate Alliance 2. You know, there was an X-Men Legends 2 that a lot of people kind of viewed as a step back from the original. Mm-hmm. So people kind of thought maybe that format from Activision had hit its high water mark,
right.
But clearly that was not the case.
I think it's just that excitement you get when you infuse so many new characters into a game. In the sequel, you're kind of trying to out-clever yourself. You can be like, all right, how can we make this game interesting but with the same characters? But just there's something about that first game that's hard to top.
You kind of touched on a lot of the great elements of the game, just the overall atmosphere, the overall the exploration of the Marvel Universe, the story itself, which was so well written, so well executed. But just from a pure playing a video game standpoint, the first time that you got three friends together, I played it on PS2, so I had the multi-tap, and the first time we got four people together to play as a squad, as like, Black Panther and Deadpool and Iron Man and Wolverine as a team. It's like, it was mind blowing. It was like you couldn't believe, my God, I'm playing as these characters I never thought I would ever get to play as in a video game. Oh, and Wolverine, who's had like a billion video games. But you know, it was just so much fun. The, being able to like level your characters up, the RPG elements were so well done on this one.
Yep.
Being able to level yourself up, and then I really want to give love to the awesome alternate costumes.
Yes.
Yep.
So freaking amazing.
They're like, so deep cuts.
Yeah.
And each, but not just like the level of like reference that went into it, but then each costume had its own little like statistical benefit or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it actually made for a slightly different gameplay experience rather than just an aesthetic difference. So, yeah, that was amazing.
And, I mean, who wouldn't want to turn Captain America into U.S. agent? Am I right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Thor as Beta Ray Bill. I mean, I every time I would turn Iron Man into War Machine because I've always been a War Machine guy. So just a great game from that standpoint of digging deep into the vault, and I've always been a sucker for if you can put something like that in a game, do it. Like, yeah. If you remember the Spider-Man game on PlayStation 1, they had the Ben Reilly Spider-Man costume that you could unlock, which I was such a huge fan of. So yeah. If you can put that in a game, do it. But Nick, we've talked a lot about this. I have a feeling it'll come up on your list as well, but what's your number two?
My number two, so I tried so hard to find a justification to put this at number one, given my own personal biases and the amount of fanboy that I am for this particular series.
It's the Thor movie tie-in, isn't it?
Go fuck yourself. My number two is Ultimate Spider-Man for the GameCube. This was so cool at the time because I had finally gotten completely caught up on Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley's Ultimate Spider-Man. And I think this game actually came out after Bagley had left the title, if I remember correctly.
It did.
And what was really cool about this game is it actually told a story that the comics made reference to. Like, there was a missing story from the comics that this game filled in the gaps for. So, yeah, to actually get the entire Ultimate Spider-Man story, if you want to go through and read the entire thing or experience the entire thing from issue one to its completion, you actually have to go through and play this game. Yeah. And it was so cool, the build for it, or just how hyped I was for it. This was probably the only Marvel video game I've ever been like, I am buying this day one from GameStop, pre-ordered, that kind of deal. And when it finally got there, I remember going home immediately and over that weekend just playing straight through it in the course of like 72 hours and just could not put it down. It was so amazing. Open world concept, kind of like Spider-Man 2, which I think a lot of people probably remember a little bit better and a little bit more fondly than this one. But it introduced the element of Venom as a playable character, and he actually played a little bit differently, where instead of web-swinging around the city, you could actually do the old 60s-style Hulk jumps, you know, where you would kind of jump straight up into the air and bound from building to building or whatever. And it actually had a really cool, really cool dynamic with Venom, where you could run around and actually pick up passersby and drain the life out of them to replenish your health and stuff like that. But told a pretty cool story that involved the ultimate version of Carnage and Silver Sable, and had some other cameos. Like, I remember the Wolverine fight in particular during one of the Venom sequences being just so much fun, such a great cameo. And the art style, it was cel-shaded, so it actually looked like they had brought the Ultimate Universe, I mean, the panels to life and stuff, and just such a cool idea to do a video game that was, you know, important to the canon, actually meant something to the story. So, for everything that this series and this game meant to me as a teenager, I had to find a spot for Ultimate Spider-Man, and unfortunately could not ultimately justify putting it at number one like I really wanted to.
Yeah, I actually never played this one. I remember it.
Yeah, it was a GameCube. It wasn't a GameCube because it was also on PS2.
Yeah, I just never played it.
No, I never played it either. I remember hearing a lot about it, but and Bendis wrote it. He wrote the game. Yep. I remember that was a huge deal. So it definitely felt like an Ultimate Spider-Man comic, and it was cool. It was just at a time when Ultimate Spider-Man was its own franchise.
Yep.
Well, yeah, definitely. And like you said, Nick, a lot of these lists are going to come down to nostalgia and personal meaning as well, and it will for my number one for sure.
Yep.
But Ben, let's get to your number one. What is the butt of the woods, if you will?
The totally nostalgia-tinged, I don't care what anyone says, difficulty level, whatever, doesn't matter. I'm going back to what we were talking about earlier. Let's get back to the X-Men arcade game, the greatest game of all time. Oh, my God. I have two distinct memories of this game. One was when I went to summer camp, we would always go to this place called Riverside, which eventually became Six Flags New England, at the end of every summer. And they had an arcade, and they had an X-Men game in there. And while everyone else was going on rides, I was getting as many tokens as I can, because we only got so many because we're at summer camp, to go and play the X-Men arcade game. And I remember one time it just started pouring, and there was lightning, and there was thunder. And if you were in the arcade, you were just out of being soaked, and all my friends were getting soaked because they were trying to run on roller coasters and everything else. I was just stayed in the safety of the arcade playing as Cyclops or Wolverine who had laser claws, because the people who made the X-Men arcade game just understood powers so much better than anyone who's ever worked on the comics, and how powers can be cool. But I just played all day while everyone else was getting soaked, and I remember it kept seeming like there was lightning, I swear, coming down within 3 feet of us or something. And I was like, they're going to shut down this game. They're going to shut down this game. Please let us beat the game. Please let us beat the game. And we finally did it. We beat Magneto. We had the big triumph. And it was exactly what you guys were talking about before, where it was like, you know, five other kids who I had never met in my life before who now are like my best friends because we'd just been through a war together. And it was so fun. It was just so great. And the other memory I have, which I should have led with because it's not as cool as the plane in the midst of the lightning one, is I remember finding a game at the Polynesian Resort at Walt Disney World, and that was like the best part of my vacation, was setting records with Cyclops on that game. But no, this game was so fun, and when it came back out, like I said, it wasn't quite the same playing it at home, but I don't think I've ever had a video game experience that has ever compared to X-Men the arcade game. It's just head and shoulders above everything else for me.
That's awesome, dude. Like that, and it's so funny you mentioned that because I remember my fondest memory of playing the game was also on a vacation. I was visiting my grandparents. At the time, I lived in South Florida, and I was visiting them in Mobile, Alabama. And they still love then and still do love to go to Biloxi to the casino boats there and gamble. So they would go over to gamble, and they would drop me off in the arcade and go off and gamble. So
that's awesome.
I would be in the I would wander around the arcade. That's where I played the Punisher a lot. But I remember I was just walking around there one day. Maybe the first day I went there, I was just wandering around. I had a bunch of tokens, but I didn't know what to do. And I saw this one kid playing the X-Men game, and he looked at me and he said, "Hey, you want to play?"
Yeah.
And that was so cool to me because I didn't have a lot of friends, and so. And I would never see this kid again, obviously, but I walked over and I said, sure. And so I walked over and I went to the Colossus slot and I put my token in and we played. And then pretty soon we were joined by another kid and then another kid. And we ended up four of us stayed the entire time until we beat the game. And I remember
that was the beauty of the X-Men arcade game. It just like brought people together like nothing else I can think of. It was amazing.
What if they dropped an X-Men arcade cabinet in the Middle East? Like, I feel like it would have solved a lot of problems.
It would solve everything. It would save so much time and manpower. It would just there's nothing that an X-Men arcade game can't solve.
That should be, instead of the next presidential debate, let's just drop an X-Men arcade cabinet.
That would be my platform if I ran. I would run on the X-Men arcade platform.
And you would also, if you became elected, you would force Marvel to institute Wolverine's laser claws as an actual
power. Oh my god. It just makes so much sense.
And his Australian accent, let's not forget that.
Yes. Most
and now you understand why, again, that was such a huge moment for me when I got Pride of the X-Men. I ordered Pride of the X-Men not knowing the connection. So when I watched it for the first time and realized I was watching a cartoon based on the X-Men arcade game, which was actually vice versa, it was the most incredible moment.
I like to think that Hugh Jackman was chosen because of Pride
absolutely.
Of the X-Men, that the Australia tie was really what synced him in for Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
Well, Nick, I know what the answer is, but tell us your number one selection.
My number one is Marvel Ultimate Alliance.
Good pick.
For all the reasons you guys laid out. I mean, I have not yet bitten the bullet on the remaster that came out recently. I'm waiting for the price to drop a little bit, but once I do, I'm sure it will hold up.
Yeah, price. Well. Yeah, it was really expensive.
Yeah, $60 for two games that I already own. If I just want to turn on my Xbox 360, is a little ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I totally didn't get it for free.
Oh, damn it. Anyway, at some point when the price dropped, I'm looking forward to revisiting that experience. But I remember I replayed this game probably once a year, you know, during the entire console life of the 360, which I know is still running, but I mean, before it was, you know, replaced by the current generation. Like you guys said, I mean, the alternate costumes, the roster depth, just everything about it was so much fun. And like Ben called out, all the places you get to go. I mean, whether it's the S.H.I.E.L.D. helicarrier or Atlantis or Asgard or, you know, Doomstad, you know, just so many cool locales from the Marvel universe that have not really been represented in video game form before or since.
Yeah.
I loved playing through it so much. I remember when you would get four people together, I would actually have a hard time following my character. So I'd always play as Iron Man and just spam the Unibeam attack because it would bounce off the walls. And so if I ever lost my character, I could just press one button over and over again and still feel like I was contributing to the team. And then like Greg and I were talking earlier today, I got to ask a question. Did anyone ever actually play as Susan Storm?
Oh, yeah.
Who?
There were people at Wizard who play as Sue Storm all the time, man. She was we'd want to play as the Fantastic Four.
The Fantastic Four.
Yeah, we wanted to play as Fantastic Four. Sense. So someone had to be Sue Storm, but her powers are actually pretty badass, just like in the comics. See, to me, I've never had trouble understanding why people dig Sue Storm. I've always said that other than Jonathan Hickman, I don't know anyone whose favorite Fantastic Four character is Mr. Fantastic. Like, that's no one's favorite character.
No one. The only appealing thing about Mr. Fantastic in this game is they actually called one of his attacks Propeller Arms.
Yeah.
It looked ridiculous, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
You know, that was
Propeller Arms
cool.
of Freedom.
That was
I remember when I finally got the DLC, I think maybe almost 2 years after the game was released, I remember the Doctor Doom DLC being, like, game-breaking, mm-hmm. to the point where nothing that you, that was in the game was a challenge to you, because you could just run through as Doom and destroy yeah. everything, and it was awesome.
There was nothing quite as cool as the Galactus fight in that game.
Oh, the Galactus fight yeah. is so cool.
No, I
marked out big for the Destroyer fight, mm-hmm. because it was just such a cool way of working around that comic concept of the Destroyer, which I was always a mark for being the Thor fan that I am. So I loved how they portrayed, you know, the idea that you can't actually defeat the Destroyer, and so you have to kind of outsmart Loki in some way.
Right.
I loved how that was handled in that game.
Yeah, no, I am like the world's farthest removed from Fantastic Four fan, but I like the Thing and the Human Torch. I've just always found Reed and Sue to be kind of, I don't know, lackluster.
But which a lot of people do.
But in the game, it was like you'd almost have to pick Reed just for the ridiculous attacks. The one where he turns himself into a rubber ball and rolls across the screen. That was entertaining. But I have two Marvel Ultimate Alliance questions, actually, that I'm hoping you might be able to answer, Ben.
All right, let's see. Number one,
why wasn't Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 a continuation of the story of this one? Because this one ends where Galactus makes an mm-hmm. ominous threat to come after Earth, basically, and devour it. Was there a reason why they didn't do that?
I think it was just someone pitched – I mean, I don't know this for sure, so I'm not speaking from a place of authority, but I feel like it was just someone pitched the idea of, oh, we could do Civil War, and that was just too – great a carrot to resist. And I think they had different people working on the game, not completely. I mean, it was the same basic studio, but I think they just, you know, they were like, we had Civil War, it's this incredibly successful franchise, this incredibly successful event, surely it'll translate over. But I'm pretty much asking the same question as you.
Okay, my second question is, I was under the impression that both of the Ultimate Alliance games sold really well. Why then did they stop making this series in particular, or even these kinds of games? It feels like right. it's been forever since we've had one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't been on the inside of Marvel games. I kind of am now, but I wasn't back then, so I don't really know what happened, why they didn't make them. I do know that people are asking about console games all the time. And I know that we announced that we're doing a Spider-Man game for console next
year.
Which
looks excellent, by the way.
Yeah, which is a pretty big deal. It's the first console game we've done in a little while. So as a fan, I hope it means a return to form and we get to see, mm-hmm. you know, the next logical iterations of a lot of these games. But I can't speak from authority on that, but I can just say that I hope they come back.
Well, not to put you on the spot or anything, but I have read some rumors that perhaps the remaster editions were testing the waters for a potential return to the series. Can you speak on that at all?
I cannot speak on that.
All right. It's worth a shot.
Worth a shot.
Always worth a shot. I guess I should move on to my number one, which we talked about the nostalgic value of the games that are on our lists, whether it be Nick's number two, Ultimate Spider-Man, whether it be Ben's number one, the X-Men arcade game. For me, the nostalgic value comes in at my number one pick, which is another X-Men game. Stop me if you've heard this before. The X-Men Sega Genesis game from 1993. This was a great game, and this was
so fucking hard.
So hard. So hard. This was like one of the first games, probably the first Genesis game, I would say. Yeah, I'm comfortable saying that. The first Genesis game that I became obsessed with.
Yeah.
And maybe my favorite game on the entire Genesis console. I remember my dad got this for me not long after it came out because I was such a huge X-Men fan at age 9. I thought the world revolved around Bret Hart and the X-Men. and sometimes not in that order. And so when my dad got this for me, I literally played it. I didn't do anything else when I was in my free time for like a week. It was every day when I'd get done with my schoolwork, okay, I'm playing X-Men. And this game was so ahead of its time. The graphics were awesome for the time. The character designs were those classic Jim Lee designs that I love so much that we saw in the cartoon.
You know what I remember, strangely enough? The music.
The music was great. Was amazing.
Yeah.
Like the classic theme song that I can never forget, and the music that played during the levels was great. You had Wolverine, Gambit, Cyclops, and Nightcrawler as playable characters, but what made this game unique was each of them actually had different mutant powers that you could use, and it was two-player co-op. So you could both be playing, you know, one of you could be Wolverine, one of you could be Gambit on a console system, and it not be that corny, over-the-top view that so many games had. Mm-hmm. Just awesome. Like, the levels were clever. It was right out of the comics. The fact that you could, you know, you guys mentioned on Maximum Carnage, you could use the character heads to call in help. This game kind of introduced that concept.
Yep.
Right? I mean, you had Archangel you could call in.
Jean Grey.
Storm. Yep, Jean Grey you could call
Jean Grey would just come and help you if you fucked up.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah,
she would just, like, retrieve you out of holes and stuff.
Yeah, if you fucked up.
That was great. Yep.
Iceman would come by and build an ice bridge levels and stuff. Rogue would come by and punch dudes in the face, which was awesome. And you know, I'll own up to it. Russell can make fun of me all he wants. I was a huge Gambit mark, so I picked Gambit all the time and would take particular pleasure out of having Rogue come by to save Gambit's ass. So just
Gambit is awesome, no matter what turds in the punch bowl of life, like Russell Sellers may say.
That's right, Russell. I would play the hell out of this with my friends whenever my few friends would come over to play it. We would have a lot of fun with it. And yes, it's one of the hardest games that you'll ever play, but I still to this day have a perverse enjoyment of the Mojo World level because I couldn't figure it out forever. And the fact that they were that clever, and I know a lot of people hate that, but I still think it's so clever to put in the idea that you can only get through the level by hitting the reset button on your system.
Dude, I never knew about that until I was a teenager. Like, until the internet came along, I had no idea how to beat that level.
Yep.
I never even got to that level. this game was so hard.
It was really hard.
I can't emphasize it enough.
You had, in order to get, the other thing that I loved about it, in order to get to the higher levels, you actually had to play as the X-Men, even the ones you might not have wanted to play as. Because there were some levels I never would have gotten through without Nightcrawler. Because Nightcrawler was the cheapest character to play as.
Teleportation,
Because
you could teleport through walls and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was just a blast. And when I think back on this game, I think back to that era of X-Men, which we've talked about on this podcast before, myself and Tim Capel. You've talked about it on Seller's Points, Ben. It was just – it's hard to explain now, but it was almost a perfect era for X-Men fans, for kids anyway that were X-Men fans. The cartoon was going strong. The video games were awesome. The comic books were crazy and fun. And it was just a really good time to be an X-Men. And it was an era, like you said, when the X-Men ruled the roost at the time. You know, it wasn't the Avengers company. It was the X-Men's company. So, yeah,
absolutely. Just a fun
time. Well, that wraps up our lists. And I think we had some pretty classic games on our list. A lot of crossover, as we expected here, on our list. But I also solicited a little bit of Twitter feedback heading into this one from people asking what some of their favorite Marvel games of all time were. I've got a few people that responded here. Russell, actually. I'm going to mention some of the ones he mentioned that didn't make any of our lists. X-Men Mutant Apocalypse was the game we were looking for, by the way, Ben, for the Super Nintendo. Spider-Man 2 for the PS2, which briefly mentioned by Nick, amazing game. One of the best movie tie-ins of all time. I think we probably all agree on that.
In terms of superhero movie tie-ins, it might be the best superhero movie tie-in of all time.
Let's see, what else did you put on there that didn't make our list? Everything else made our list. Let's see, who else responded to it?
Russell pretty much nailed all five of the games that were on my list, so not a ton of extra there.
Royce Murray suggests pretty much all of the Capcom Marvel fighting games.
All of them
highly successful. Let's see here. We got a suggestion of X-Men Origins Wolverine. A nice suggestion. That was a really good movie tie-in game. Did you play that one, Ben?
No, I didn't. It was a fantastic movie.
Oh, one of the best movies of all time. particularly the best usage
Ben is in
Cyclops
no way being compensated to say that.
Yeah, right.
Right. It was also the best usage of Cyclops, Gambit, and Deadpool.
All your favorites.
Absolutely. My personal favorite moment for that movie is like creepy.
When it ends.
Besides when it ends, it's creepy. Hey, I've got candy in my van. Professor X coming out of the woods and beckoning all the children towards him.
Yeah.
Yes. Carrying on in the classic tradition of video game movie tie-ins, the game actually doesn't have anything to do with the movie.
Kind of like that other Wolverine game, X2 yep. Wolverine's Revenge, X2 Wolverine's where Revenge, Mark Hamill actually voiced Wolverine yep. for the game.
I was going to throw a shout-out to that, because you know who wrote that game? Larry Hama, the long-time
really?
Wolverine.
No kidding. Huh.
The 80s and 90s, yep. It was a great game, guys. Like it almost made
my list.
It was so good. But this Wolverine Origins tie-in that was suggested on Twitter – it was really fun. Like, it's just a balls-to-the-wall, violent, you know, gory, mature-rated Wolverine game, the Unleashed Edition anyway, and much, much better than the movie it was based on. Let's see if we had any other suggestions. Looks like that may have been it. Yeah, that was it. But yeah, so definitely thanks to those of you on Twitter who reached out and gave us some of your suggestions. Sounds like a lot of us had the same ideas going into this of the classic Marvel games. Were there any that you guys considered for your list that you had to just leave on the outside?
The one that springs to mind most instantly is the Spider-Man game for N64 and PlayStation. That was the first 3D Spider-Man game. I remember it featured Doc Ock as the main villain. I don't remember a ton else about it. I know that, like you said, Greg, it had the Ben Reilly costume and had a variety of different costumes that you could unlock that provided you with different abilities in the game. That's probably the one that sticks out to me the most that I wanted to find a spot for on my list and just couldn't.
What about you, Ben?
I was really glad you had the X-Men Genesis game as number one, because that was the one that was kind of on the outside looking in for me. I left it off my list just because of the sheer insane difficulty of it, but it was close to making the list even despite that. So that was the one that I'm glad that one got plenty of love.
Yeah, the ones that came closest to knocking Punisher out of the five spot for me were X2 Wolverine's Revenge, X2 Wolverine's Revenge, the Wolverine Origins tie-in, and Spider-Man 2, which, again, amazing game. I'm not trying to sell it short at all. But, so with all that being said, we hope you all enjoyed the show. Hope you enjoyed the countdown. We are super excited that Ben got to join us.
This was awesome. Oh, yeah, I definitely want to come back again. This was a lot of fun, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And where can people follow you on Twitter, and where can people listen to you here on Place to Be?
You can follow my certified Twitter account at Ben J. Morse. I'm still pretty excited about that, even though it's so easy to get certified these days. You just have to send them an email. But you can follow me at Ben J. Morse. All my work stuff goes on over at Marvel.com. Go on iTunes and listen to my weekly podcast, This Week in Marvel. And coming up at New York Comic Con, we'll be having our usual Marvel live stream. And you can check that one out. It'll probably be at Marvel. It will be at Marvel.com. Not probably. It will definitely be at Marvel.com. So check that out during New York Comic Con. And then as far as Place to Be stuff, I host the monthly Rewind show. And I contribute on Main Event wherever else I can.
Awesome. Now, that's some high-quality promotion right there.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the first things you learn.
Absolutely. You can't put a price tag on that. Mm-hmm. Now, as for Nick and I, we hope you've enjoyed this. We've got a whole litany of things lined up this month. This month, of course, being November. And we hope that you will enjoy all of our usual content, long book hunters, off the page, whatever else we decide to throw your way. Oh, and the continuing Marvel series, of course, known as what is it known again? Oh, the Hard Travelers for Hire. Very good idea from the esteemed Mr. Duke. We will be continuing that series. We hope you all enjoy that one. Nick, do you have any parting words for our listening audience?
I don't think so.
Yeah, and of course, when I was talking about New York Comic Con, I meant it happened a month ago.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, folks. If you want to, you can go and check out
check out the archival content at marvel.com/NYCC16.
there you have it. So from Ben Morse, from Nick Duke, have a good one, folks. Read a comic and have a great week. We'll catch you next week.